good evening, good afternoon, good morning, good brunch time, maybe. It's DC Spectre Talk commentary time, and it's been a while. It's been a while since we've done one of these. We're going back to Bond, and it's Dave's favourite Bond movie, isn't it, Dave?
It is. I've been counting the days. And thankfully, it's been fucking thousands of them.
Where does this rank for you? Was this dead bottom for
no,
you?
No, Diamonds Are... It was second bottom. Diamonds Are Forever was flat bottom. And I haven't watched all the Bond films through for a while in terms of giving them a ranking, so I'm trusting to the ranking we gave 7 years ago, but it was bottom then.
Die Another Day was ranked too high on your list, Dave.
That was... I can't remember if that... No, I think The Man with the Golden Gun was the next one up, and then it was Die Another Day or something like
still
that.
Still ranked too high.
I'm never bored, but I don't like Die Another Day. I can't buy into this, oh, it's a lot of fun, or it's a beer and pizza movie. I've heard people say that, and I fully respect anyone's opinion like that. I don't feel that strongly about it, but it's not like I've ever enjoyed it, but I've never been as bored, and the bottom three films just fucking bore me so badly. And that's why Die Another Day doesn't fall in the bottom three, but I do think objectively it's probably the worst.
Yeah, it's the silliest, isn't it? It's kind of a bit more like, what the hell were you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I ripped it apart in print when I sort of wrote about it, but I'm never particularly bored by it, to be fair. Whereas Octopussy bores me. I'm kind of pissed off by it. I've just never really liked it. I'm aware that there's films that people that are possibly worse. I stuck it below The Man with the Golden Gun, and I'm not actually sure it's worse than The Man with the Golden Gun, but I like it less.
Yeah.
Diamonds, I just found a miserable, misogynistic fucking mess. And if you're gonna make a Roger Moore film 2 years early, don't put a miserable fucking bastard in the lead role like he is in it. At least Roger looked like he was enjoying himself.
Yeah.
But I mean, only a certain kind of Bond can pull off the sort of pissed off to be here look, and Sean in 1971 wasn't it, he just looked a bit out of shape and bored. But no, Octopussy would probably be the one I enjoy watching least, and it's probably, possibly anyway, the one I know least, in that I've seen every scene of the film multiple times, but like I can toss off what happens in other Bond films a lot quicker than I can Octopussy, because I just struggle with concentration with it.
But this is going to be a fun episode.
What this is hinting at for anyone who came to us late, which is, well, I wouldn't expect anyone to have heard nearly 8 years of episodes.
If you have, that's amazing. Congratulations.
They've slowed in recent years, and actually they're not all there anyway. Chris will look into it at some point, but some of the earlier ones are missing since we've been migrated and stuff. But they're all pretty much.
Remind me, which ones are missing now?
Just have a look on a Spotify or something like that, and you'll find that there's a few early ones missing and so on. Or it appears that way anyway.
The important ones, like actually the original.
They're all on YouTube, aren't they?
They are all on YouTube. Although early on, because I couldn't be, I thought the sort of copyright things were more serious than they were. Strikes are, but when they say, you know, we can't monetize this video or adverts may play, that's of no import really. So some of the early ones I cut out intro music and stuff like that, but they are all there. What's missing is, I don't know, I think all the summer reviews are there, because some of them were done under the Cinematronics label, not under the label for this show. All of our bonus episodes are there, because for anyone who's come to us late, the numbered episodes are the numbered episodes, but Christmas charity, and I think we did one for a commission once. We did The Crow for a commission once. They're not numbered. And so there are a few extra ones as well. Plus, all of us together have guested on a couple of other podcasts as well. Do you expect us to talk as guested on other podcasts? So it's difficult to get the completeness, but the point I think I'm making is it's not beyond the realms of possibility that you haven't all heard the Octopussy episode we did. And I could dance around this, but let's put it bluntly, I was very, very drunk, right? And I repeated myself. I thought it would
in
be
a White House accent.
I thought it would be a bit of a laugh, and it sort of was, because I think it's an entertaining episode, but I am repeating myself terribly. The number of times I said he's too old, you know, is like getting ridiculous. And I when it finished, I thought, I've said what I think, but I've not really been fair there. So it's not something I want to strike from the record. I stand by it all, and it's part of our canon, and I'm not ashamed of it. And you do change over time. I made jokes in early, one or two jokes, which I won't repeat now, in early episodes I wouldn't make now. It's part of, like, growing and changing. So I stand by all of our canon, but it's the one episode I look back on and go, I ain't proud of that. I'm not proud of that at all. Now, I could sit and slag off Octopussy tonight, but the fact is, I'm sober, so hopefully I'll balance humour and a bit of acid a bit better, and perhaps be a bit fairer to the bits of the film that are good, because they do exist. I think I once said in writing that it's one of the two films that never gave me any pleasure. That's actually slightly disingenuous, because you get to the Property of a Lady part of the film, think that bit's very well done. So I can't say I didn't enjoy that, because that bit of the film in isolation isn't bad. But the overall effect is, Roger stopped being... Not only did was Roger not really able to do action, but he stopped even trying. He was getting doubled when there weren't stunt doubles that looked close enough to him. So it kept taking me out of the film. And they never... Unlike Never Say Never Again was released the same year, and they wisely aged Bond in it. Yes, he's still shagged around, but they at least said, you know, you're a bit past your prime. Whereas Roger Moore was still gallant banter around with 20-somethings, like, I don't think they were facing reality. He needed to have been replaced a couple of years before this, in my view. And you've got the slight visual thing as well. Grace Jones always said he had the stiffest hair she'd ever seen. And it's because he did thin. He never went completely bald, but he thinned. And in later years, they had to arrange it and then spray it quite heavily. And so for Your Eyes Only onwards, his hair looks rather fake, even though it's kind of not. So, yeah, the 80s weren't that kind to him, even though as a man, he aged fairly well in life.
Yeah, I think it's odd, because I think it's one of those things where at the time it was almost like the done thing, because there was plenty of, like, those types of action films where you had older stars. And so it was probably that kind of it probably fitted in with, like, one of those, really. And I think at this point Roger was a face of the franchise, and kind of like just almost like part of the furniture.
They were all very cozy at this point. You know, you knew what you were going to get. It wasn't going to rock any boats. It was going to do decent box office, but not blow anyone's socks off. It would look quite like the last film, in that the set pieces would be in different places and you'd have different singers, but you were broadly getting variants of the same film every 2 years. And there must have been some pleasure in that. I mean, I don't know which I would take, because at the moment we don't get anything like enough Bond films, and the sort of deconstructionist trend now means that our heroes never really have any fun. So, I mean, I've just seen the latest Indiana Jones film, and I was quite fucking depressed at the end of it, to be honest with you.
See our review of that.
I've got a written review on Set the Tape. Oh, and we did a show on it, didn't we? Sorry, yeah.
At least they didn't kill him off anyway, so.
Yeah, and
which makes
and
a nice
so,
change.
You know, if you offer me a Bond
probably
film...
Probably heavily rewritten at the end.
Probably. And you ride off into the sunset.
But if you gave me a Bond film every 6 years, and I'll feel a bit ambivalent about it, although it's definitely made to a high quality, versus every other year's, and it's comfort food and extremely formulaic, I'm not actually sure which I would pick. So I don't want to slag the 80s. Certainly of the 80s, I like 3 of the 5 films really a lot. You know?
Yeah, for me, it's always an interesting thing, because quite a lot of things that I've done the past, like, year or so, is I've always sort of had a bit of a what-if kind of, like, thing, you know, like or what if Lazenby have stuck around, even if he just did one other movie, how that would have changed the franchise going forward. And what if, like, Roger bowed out after Moonraker, which it was, because it was always one of the things that he kept coming back for one more. They kept, like, negotiating with him.
It was one at a time, yeah.
Yeah. And it was just
even though most of the sort of screen tests and stuff that ever got done for replacements for him seemed and I might be misremembering this. Again, 7 years ago, I knew all this stuff because I did all the reading for the show. Mm. And funnily enough, I'm listening to the Nobody Does It Better audiobook at the moment, which is written by the same people who did the two volumes of The 50-Year Mission, which was the full oral history of Star Trek. They've also done one called Secrets of the Force for the entirety of Star Wars, which I don't have. But I went through all the Star... I was having a bit of a Star Trek phase recently, so I had to listen to all of that again. And I've started going through Bond, but in terms of where I am with it, I'm just starting, like, when they were making Honor Majesty's Secret Service. So I'm nowhere near what happened in the Roger Moore run. But from memory, all the screen tests like Lewis Collins, James Brolin, etc. took place for this film. But in reality, I think that as soon as Never Say Never Again was going to happen, if you were going to replace Roger, you were going to do it for the previous film, not this one.
Yeah, I was only just to sort of come back to the, my always view of it was, I always wonder, if Dalton came in on A Few Eyes Only, you know, when I last watched A Few Eyes Only, I was like, I can totally see Dalton in this.
I think it's a Dalton film, yeah.
And I just thought, what how colour the whole franchise like after that? Yeah. Like, you know, what would Octopus be like if Dalton wanted, A View to a Kill would have been probably a lot better with Dalton.
Oh, I agree. I mean, the thing is, For Your Eyes Only was written fairly neutral, whereas this one, again, was written for Roger, so it's silly. Yeah. Should we get into it?
Yeah, let's watch it.
All right.
And we'll miss the score by Stanley Rogers in...
That's
Sorry about that. That's a
Smith and Jones. What is it? Yeah, he also wrote one for Apocalypse Now.
Yes.
I will put that on our social media. The Smith and Jones sketch where he does a song. He goes around like pitching to do music, and he did one for Gandhi, one for Octopussy, and one for Apocalypse Now. I'll find it.
Yeah.
Go on, Chris.
Okay. So on the count of three, 1, 2, and 3.
All right.
Seen so, Leo Roar cool. there.
Yeah.
Crap, I might want to put it on mute.
I've deliberately sort of left Bond for a little while. Not for any sense of dislike, but I just wasn't in the mood. And I just wonder if it's just starting to flare up again. I bought a few of them on Amazon just for
Isn't
ease.
The flares? There's Roger's flares.
There he is. Shot
Did
in
you
know 1977.
When was it changed over... when was it he changed over for the gun barrel?
After the first two. After the first two, because the first two are shot 185:1.
Yep.
They're the only ones in the franchise shot at that aspect ratio, whereas this is back to CinemaScope.
Yeah.
And that changed with The Spy Who Loved Me, so they reshot it. He's in a lounge suit in his first two.
Lounge suit. Sorry, Bond, the lounge suit lizard.
Yeah.
So this is, I think most people kind of think fondly of this one of the better title sequences for Roger.
His best is The Spy Who Loved Me by a mile.
Yeah.
Oh. It's more self-contained, isn't it? Because like traditionally when the series started, it was kind of like Bond, finishing the previous mission. Yeah. I think as they went along, it got a lot more self-contained. So.
Yeah, and then there was a period where they've sort of come into being part of the main film, really.
Yeah. You can see the evolution of the pre-titles.
Yeah. I would say Spy Who Loved Me is his best. I would say... ironically enough, I think it's a tie for his worst for me. I think it's a tie between A View to a Kill because of all the California girls bollocks from We're the Beach Boys, honestly. And I really
there's a Telegraph or something. There's an auction coming up in October full of basically some of Roger's personal effects. I think his address book. Some of the outfits that he wore to the various premieres, and also I think the white ski suit that he wore from A View to a Kill,
okay.
going under the hammer, I think probably to raise funds for UNICEF perhaps.
So we could buy his address book and, you know, date some of his old birds.
Well, this they're is
like,
it.
They're probably old ladies now, but we'll have a go.
And also a treasure trove. Imagine, you know, just a celebrity like Roger Moore who knew everybody. Just open it up. And
he did know everybody, but I'm just imagining with the women, you open it and there's asterisks against some of them, you know.
Like, call her for a good time.
Yeah. I also really, even though I love the film, I don't like the For Your Eyes Only pre-title. I really don't.
That's a bit meandering.
Wasting our time by way of trying to say fuck off to Kevin McClory. It's like, keep your arguments to yourself, please.
Mm.
This one's okay, except...
Judo Chop.
Although I would say,
Job.
Hiya! He ought to say that, shouldn't he?
He should say hiya.
Yeah. I do think I don't think a false moustache does what any good at making him look any younger, though, to be fair.
No, but he does look like the guy he's meant to be.
He
doubling.
Does. Well, do you know what? Like, you know why, don't you? It was his stunt double.
It was, that's why, yeah, it was Roger's stunt double.
Yeah.
But that's why, yeah, fun fact.
And that looks like not Charles Dance. Like, as he looks now, do you know what I mean?
He could be Charles Dance, but he's not.
As he is now.
He made a cameo appearance in Furious Only.
And I have to say, I very rarely found that there's a difference between Roger Moore's jokey and Roger Moore's funny. I don't think there were a hell of a lot of lines in his runs I laughed at. Most of his laughs came in the pre-title to The Spy Who Loved Me. But I must say, the last line before we go into the titles made me laugh.
Pull it up, please.
Yeah, that made me laugh. I love this here, though. He said, hey, look at that. I said in the original review, this is the difference between the two genders.
Yeah.
If it was a woman and I was driving the other vehicle, I couldn't drive up and pull up my trouser leg, could I? Why, some bird goes, look at him, look at those thighs.
It's a bit double standard, isn't it, almost? Like, if it was, you know, super...
No, it's how dumb men are. We're all like, look, women! Whereas, like, I don't think if a woman was sat there with a gun, she'd be, like, distracted.
I think Bob Bond is playing on the stereotypes.
Yeah.
Playing sexuality. I mean, you know, as an agent, obviously he uses all means at his disposal, including his sexuality, to get what he wants.
Yeah. Hello.
See, look, he's smitten. Look, keep your eye on the wheel, please.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't think... Obviously, it's the 40th anniversary of the film this year.
I
don't think I've ever seen this film as many times. I have seen it so many times this year.
Why have you watched it so many times? Is it?
I think I will be done.
Why have you seen it so many times?
Well, I saw it earlier in the year because Pete showed it for his birthday, and then we showed it for Peter's also from Taylor's with Love across social media. Check out his website, check out his blog, his vlog. It's all about the sartorial side of Bond.
Yeah.
And then obviously for various JBR events, we had a group watch of it. And then obviously at the Nene Valley Railway event earlier last month, which I'll go into later on, we showed it for them, and now we're watching it this evening.
I can't tell you when, but I know I've seen it. My wife hadn't seen all the Bond films and wanted to. It wasn't something I even suggested, but in the run-up she wanted to see them all, and quite predictably she didn't slag off Roger Moore. But this, because it wasn't this whole era she didn't like, she found it, she said it was like she just called them a joke. She just thought they were far too silly.
Yeah, they are.
But
silly.
She couldn't warm to Dalton either. But then that's not unusual if you don't know the character that well.
It's a step change.
I don't think she'd really took to him either. But she certainly didn't like the later Roger Moore ones. But it was never... I think it was twin things. I don't think it was that he was too old. I think it was that they got progressively sillier. But also, if you're watching them all together, by then she's seen five or six of his and she's had enough.
Yeah, well, he did 87, it's quite a long run.
Yeah, so she wasn't a great fan.
Well, at least she's seen him, so that's good.
Yeah. So, she's seen them all. She liked Daniel Craig best. She did enjoy the Sean Connery ones quite a bit. Hey. Majesty's my favourite, and I think I've not forced it on her. I think because I've watched it a little bit more than some of the others, and because she can see how much I love it, I think she naturally like took a close look at it. And
yeah,
was like,
out why you like it so much.
And she's like, what is it? And so she took to that one as well, but I think Craig's her favourite, to be honest.
Yeah, definitely. It's more modern era.
I think there's some of it. But my point was, I was about to say, I've only seen this once since we watched it for our show, and I couldn't remember when. I can remember when. It was about...
Two years ago now.
It would have been about 2 years ago I would have seen this, probably in the build-up to No Time to Die.
I think Roger's my wife's least favourite as well. She finds him a bit creepy.
I found him a bit smarmy, to be fair, but I think that wasn't...
Also,
was
Roger's lovely.
But he was such a lovely man, I feel guilty about saying it.
It's that scene
in Moonraker where he's undressing her before he's even started chatting her up, and it's like, I'm not coy.
What do you do when you don't tango?
About three to five, hard labour. At the rate you're going, I just think that I'm not. I mean, the most problematic scenes actually in this film, this series, were probably Sean, but he just gave off this air of never thinking about anything other than sex, and I just found it a bit tiresome come the end.
Well, as you said earlier in our reviews, he's more sort of a love and not fighter, wasn't he? But yeah, I like that line. What do you do in Rio if you don't samba?
Sean's a different energy, though. Because Sean has more rugged masculinity kind of thing going on.
Yeah, I agree.
He's a bit more like... He's just
same
more
with
like
Tim as well. And Bronson's a combination of all of them.
It is a bit different, though. Because Tim's not... Well, it's hard because he only had like two films, and one of them was like a very like.
I'm sorry, I got to interrupt to ask one thing. What on earth was fucking what's he called thinking when he designed that scene? Spin around by her thighs like she's like you're trying to get her to vomit.
It's a bit silly, isn't it?
It got so tired as well. Maurice Binder is the number one reason why the Bond opening sequences look like they do today, and they're so good. So I feel bad saying it, but I just don't think they stand up very well in and of themselves.
I don't know, they kind of got a bit clever. I mean, he sort of really pioneered
this
kind of like the art form, really.
Quite like his last one, but that's last.
I kind of like how like sometimes they fit, you know, the bill. Like Live and Let Die, for example, he's kind of like voodoo sort of theme.
Yeah,
Japan,
definitely.
you got images of Mount Fuji and things like that. You Only Live Twice, for example.
They were a bit more basic early on, but actually... I think he had more ideas early on.
Yeah, it was a lot more striking as well. But obviously, with like Dr. No from Russia's Love, obviously they're very...
You knew instantly which film it is. Now this, if it wasn't for all the arms coming around him now...
Yeah, you wouldn't know.
It doesn't stand out. Why would it not be A View to a Kill? Whereas early on, Thunderball looks like water. This next one looks like Japan. Do you know what I mean?
Beautiful, cool. You can kind of tell because of the neon, and also you've kind of got like the fire and ice motifs. But I think Daniel Kleiman really brought it into his own, where he kind of included like the themes and motifs of the film itself into the title sequence for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's something that Maurice Binder was lacking towards the end.
He just uses the same props though. Like sometimes he just uses like exactly the same
Now swing around by an arm and a leg.
Yeah. I won't be surprised if these images were probably used on like Spy Luppy.
Yeah, probably.
And he's just like, oh, we'll just use that again.
I don't know. I just wonder. He probably shot them all for Thunderball and just superimposed the 70s wig on her.
My favourite is always the insertion of an outline of Roger Moore, just pop him up.
Well, you know, without these, in some of the kind of the great spy movies, they probably wouldn't have the title sequence that we do, you know, that we enjoy today. So,
yeah, absolutely. I think it's vital he had a role in the series. But when I go back and watch, particularly his later ones, it does feel like a series spinning its wheels a bit. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think even this one, I think as I've got more tolerant of Roger, I think two or three things happened. Firstly, let's be honest, he died, and I think you tend to be a bit kinder to people after that happens. I think also I went to see him. I went to see him on a live show and just really fell in love with the guy. And secondly, as I get older, you just get a little bit less judgmental. So whilst he's still at my least favourite end, I don't feel as viscerally like creeped out by him as I used to in this role.
No. So obviously we've got this amazing scene. We've gone from East Berlin to recently, which I'm not quite sure where it is in real life, to Wandsford, New Valley Railway.
The most unfair criticism in this film is the whole clown motif, because the one sequence he's dressed as a clown is tense as fuck.
It is. It's just near the end, really, to be honest. But
he's even dressed as a clown. It's like, yeah,
and
it's really well done.
Yeah, people level a lot of criticism at Roger Moore, but you know, Andy Bradford doing it in a clown costume as well.
Yeah.
And to be fair, I was lucky to meet him at the New Valley Railway. I'm going to mention that event quite a few times through this.
You've got to give us a plug in a minute. I know we've talked about it.
I've got to give us a plug.
Yeah.
I've got to do it because it was incredible. And props to Mark Hernandez, to Martin Mulder, everybody who organised it, Anders Frey, whose name I can't pronounce. Just amazing. To do the scene like in a clown outfit.
Yeah. This is kind of brutal.
It really is.
This is a 00 running for his life.
Yeah, 009 being chased by the Twins of Death.
I mean, things like the Barbara Woodhouse sit and the Tarzan yell, absolutely worth the criticism, but the clown costume's actually used correctly.
Yeah, definitely. It just goes to show, like, as a 00, you can pretty much do anything at any time.
It's John Glenn, though. John Glenn always had a bit of an edge to him. It's kind of odd with the later Roger ones, because... it's that contrast of over the top silliness,
yeah,
but with a bit of like dark.
With that's big, actually a deadly darkness. Edge to it, yeah.
With Big Ron from EastEnders. Yeah.
The Big Ron. It was a big run, but no, it was really cool at the Neon Valley event because obviously you had Tony Meyer and David Meyer.
You need to explain to those listening what that event is.
Yeah, so definitely the beginning of June, obviously it's Octopussy's 40th anniversary. There was an event organised by On the Tracks of 007, which is a sort of tour company organisation owned by Martijn Mulder's name. I can't pronounce it, I do apologise, but he's really incredible. They've organised quite a lot of events through the years, mainly around the innovation and anniversaries of the Bond films, so like You Live Twice, Majesty's. Anybody went on the
he
Majesty's
briefly appeared
event.
On one of our show, but he had to go, unfortunately. He had a scheduling error, so we ended up cutting him out of the show because he wasn't there long enough. But yeah, he did try to appear with us once.
Yeah, we'll try and have him on at some time, but he's a very busy man. But yeah, so they basically organized, so it was between him, Mark Hernandez, and a few others as well, organized an anniversary event at Neen Valley Railway in Peterborough, about 70 miles north of London. It's basically celebrating the event. I'll give a bit of a plug as well. So Mark Hernandez has written a book called On the Train Tracks, Filming Octopussy and Goldeneye at Neen Valley Railway.
So Goldeneye was shot in the same place then?
Yeah.
Not the whole thing, I mean the relevant things to trains.
The event where they get on the old Russian train, on board Trevelyan's train.
That's what I assumed you meant.
Neen Valley Railway. But the event, when we went to the event itself, the focus was more on Octopussy rather than Goldeneye. We kind of went along the train tracks, but the focus was more on Octopussy. It's obviously that celebrating the event.
I feel very conflicted when I watch him with Lois Maximoff, because we're at the point, let's be honest, and I'm trying not to be too nasty, neither of them should be there at this point, but they had a wonderful friendly ambience around each other. Let's just say that.
I don't know which pairing I prefer more, really. So, like, her with Roger, her with Sean. I think they're both kind of suited to each other. I mean, Moneypenny is a legendary character anyway. But I kind of feel
the chemistry is different, largely because of age. I think the chemistry is a little bit more, well. Sean, you get the impression she is a little bit in love with Roger. I don't really quite get that, but no, they are very 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 good friends with a flirty edge.
But like the fan theory of where they had a naughty weekend together.
That's her theory. That's the backstory
she
wrote.
Rather than with Roger.
I think. It would almost play into both, though, because let's say that did happen, which I don't buy. I don't believe
it. No, it's a fan theory.
But let's say it's a Lois Maxwell theory. It's her backstory. Mm. It's the one she came up with. Well, if that was now decades ago or some time ago, it's like they used to have a thing for each other. And so they keep up this sort of flirty ambiance as a front. Yeah, it's just a repartee they've fallen into, but it's not a real thing. This guy never got promoted, did he? The minister.
No.
Minister, not Secretary of State. Minister.
Minister.
Yeah.
He needs that job opportunities.
I do think I was very harsh on Robert Brown. I called him the worst airman, stuff like that. Bear in mind, most of this was pre the current era. You know. I will say he played better opposite Dalton. Dalton suited him better.
I think that's an age thing, though. It's like before with like with him meeting with the Moneypenny scene. It's like, oh, you're just basically acknowledging their age because you're just this younger version or like they're ready. And it doesn't kind of play the same way. It works with Dalton because there is that generation gap.
Yeah, he's Dalton's boss. He's also got quite a clipped, stern way of speaking. I think he's actually sterner than Bernard Lee, even. And that works against the no-nonsense Bond more than a bit of a clown. I don't want to be too nasty to Roger. Against Roger's energy, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. It's again in like Daylights as well. It's the kind of like he takes orders, not instincts, you know, like that kind of thing. He follows orders, not instincts.
Steve Berkoff just like steals the scene. He like eats all the scenery, the chairs, all of it.
I would liken him it's not the same energy, but he would engender the same response as Jonathan Pryce in that he's very very Marmite.
He's very kind of like intense, I think.
But he's Marmite, isn't he?
He was also due to appear at Neen Valley, but the story goes that he wanted more money at the last minute. So it was quite funny. There was obviously we were all waiting for him to appear, and then they put up signs with him at the end where he goes, but I would be a hero of the
story. He's about 92 now, though.
No, he's getting on. But he still does like the odd con and things like that. So you do kind of see him around on the fan circuit. Yeah.
He lives in this country.
But he wanted a bit more money, lastminute.com, and so they said no, sorry.
I think he's. I'd be a bit like apprehensive about because he's very much a character, and I wouldn't really know like what he'd be like.
No, he's a bit of an unknown quantity, isn't he? Because he's a bit of a chameleon in all his different roles. He's more known for kind of villainous type roles.
Think how much colder he played Victor Maitland or whatever the character was called in Beverly Hills Cop.
He's probably lovely. He's probably like when following year. Man, he's probably lovely. I don't know.
I don't know. I feel like he played that role the way you should play a Bond villain. But there you go.
He probably did. But no, we were a bit disappointed that he wouldn't be appearing, and then we kind of found out why, that he wanted a bit more money, and we thought, oh. But hey ho, his loss. But yeah, it's a shame. But that's how it goes.
I'm not in love with him in this film, but I think he's an outstanding actor. But then I feel the same way about Jonathan Pryce. I don't particularly like him in his entry, but outstanding actor.
It's a bit of a tricky one, because you've kind of got like well, I don't know if Octopussy technically is a villainess, I'm not quite sure. Probably not. Even though she's a smuggler. You've got Kumar Khan, and you've got Orloff as well. So it's a bit of a two-hander.
I tend to think of Kumar Khan as the lead villain.
Yeah. I just always struggle a little bit when you've kind of got a two or three.
But I think the film's a bit muddled anyway, but that may just be the way I experience it.
It's a bit tonally different, for sure.
Where I have to be a bit careful is, every Bond film is somebody's favourite, don't get me wrong, but I very rarely, it has happened, where people go, no, that's my favourite. But when I say to people, I don't like Diamonds Are Forever, or you say to people, I don't like Die Another Day, it's like, they kind of expect to hear that. But I do get a lot of people who, like, they say, no, Octopussy is my favourite Roger Moore.
Yeah, I'm sure there is some.
Nobody says it's their favourite film in the series, but there's some people who like Roger think it's one of his best. Now, who is that guy that's looking at? I recognise that actor, the one sat down.
I think it's Peter Porter. Just let me have a little look.
What else would I know him from?
IMDb.com. Might not be Peter Porter, I might have got it wrong. I've seen like so many times. Yeah, it's Peter Porter.
What's he best known for?
IMDb says, Living Daylights.
What was he in The Living Daylights? It could be that, couldn't it?
So yeah, when Costco's about to go and the pig down the tube, he's the guy operating the controls that Rodzika Milkos has to go and distract.
He had his face full of tits. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, he did.
Him.
Beth, what else is he?
Picturing him putting a silly face on. Yeah, I recognise.
Yeah. Oh, he's in Space 1999.
Okay.
Also in The Protectors, so in a couple of Anderson shows, so that's quite interesting. Full Temple, another ITV shows. Canterbury Tales, didn't know that. He was known within Bond films as also being that guy behind the counter.
That guy behind the counter?
Like the Christmas tree. Yeah, but, well, manning the pig, basically.
Yeah, okay.
Or is it when Dial reaches 100, it'd light up like a Christmas tree, or something like that?
Yeah. Great film, The Living Daylights. The only thing that damages it for me is I don't really like the last act very much.
But no, just fall down a little bit.
Dalton was fantastic. That's why one of the reasons I prefer License to Kill. But, now, I've heard people describe Christina Weyborn as like really odd-looking or ugly. I think she's stunning.
She's beautiful. So I've got another story to tell you about Neen Valley Railway.
Yeah.
About how I shared a dessert with Christina Weyborn.
Yeah.
So yeah.
What? So it was like two girls, one cup.
Two girls, one dessert. But not like that.
Not chocolate ice cream.
No, it wasn't. It was all very above board. Nothing dodgy at all.
Okay.
Not like that well-known internet dirty meme. So at the event, obviously, we had a nice big gala dinner on the Saturday.
She looks fantastic. I saw the photos.
Yeah, check it out, definitely.
She looks so. I can't say she looks the same. That's ridiculous. But she looks.
I think
amazing.
She does look the same.
Considering it's four decades later, she looks as close to the same as you could imagine, if you
absolutely
know what I mean.
Absolutely beautiful.
Her hair's really the cool. same, her build's the same, her facial structure's the same.
Yeah, she's teeny tiny. Teeny tiny. She's a sportswoman. She's, kind of very sporty, very athletic. Obviously going fishing, quite a lot in a native country.
Which is her native country.
A very kind of outdoors sort of thing. So she's like Nordic lady.
Nordic. Okay.
Yeah, basically, yeah, we were quite lucky for, you know, to be seated at these kind of round tables, and we were lucky to have like a guest from the film like at each one of the different tables.
Okay.
So we were lucky to be on Christina Weybourne's table. Yeah. But it's quite funny, obviously, because at these Bond events.
Who did I see photographed with her? Was it Victoria Hodges or somebody like that?
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh no, I don't think she went.
Who was it? I can't remember. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But I saw a photo of her with someone, and that someone was not you.
No, it might have been some other ladies that attended. But yeah, okay. These kind of Bond events, like female attendees are kind of somebody's wife or girlfriend.
Yeah.
But yeah, we had Christina at our table.
I mean, Louis left, because Louis Jourdan's left. Vijay's still alive.
Yeah, he's still going. I think he sent in a video message, or might not have. He'd sent in a sort of a voice note saying sorry he couldn't be there. Kabir Bedi couldn't attend because he was at a book signing in somewhere in Spain. But basically,
I mean, who does it leave if Berkoff doesn't turn up? Because all of the MI6 people are gone now.
Yeah, well, we had Paul Weston couldn't be there because he was away doing another event.
Okay.
But we had a lot of the other surviving cast and crew, like John Glenn, the chap who retired Kabir Bedi's turban. They were saying he was fantastic. He was a real
heat. Well, John Glenn's the director, so great, fantastic.
Yeah, John Glenn was there. Tony
He's about 92 now as well.
Most of the survivors, apart from obviously Berkoff and Sarwaj, is obviously left us, but most of the surviving.
You've got to get to these things if and when you can. It's difficult for me down here. And in fact, I didn't know of the event beforehand, although I should, because I follow all these things online, but I didn't pick it up anyway. But, you know, the few that are left are like 90 something now.
Yeah.
With Christina aside, it's very, very difficult to think, though. You know, 40 years ago, I don't think she's got to be in her 70s, but like the rest of them are 90s or gone.
No, that's it. And especially a lot of them kind of not living around the UK as well. Like, I mean, yeah. I think Christina, she spends a lot of her time like here or in America or in Sweden, for example. But yeah, we're lucky to have her on the table. It's with JBR guys, so like obviously Brian, Jason, people like that. Obviously fighting over who's going to sit next to her. So I think it kind of went Brian, then myself. But yeah, it just kind of ended up, you know.
Maybe it was like Brian I saw with her.
Yeah, I think it might have been. Well, it's many photos because she's very lovely. But yeah, but she was really friendly, quite engaging, quite happy to chat to us, find out about all of us as well. Obviously, we were Chris Wright, JBR fame, was like the consummate host.
It was him. I definitely saw a photo of him, and I just thought about him because of what happened to him last year, and I was like, hope he's okay.
But yeah, it was. I think it's like first sort of major Bond event that you could kind of been to after everything.
Take note, Eon, two fucking doors.
Yeah, literally two. Bloody count. Oh my god. Next time they get it right. We swapped desserts, so it was very lovely. But it was amazing, and she was just so warm and gracious.
Good.
And that's what basically, you know, all the guests kind of said.
It's lovely when they don't let you down, isn't it?
It was just nice. It was just very lovely, considering, you know, she's this major movie star. Unfortunately, a few members of cast and crew couldn't make it, but they sent in voice messages, which is really nice.
What's very nice to see, and I'm going to pay it a compliment here, is by the 1980s, he's been in the role forever. He's getting more expensive to sort of serve. The film's box office is not keeping pace, in that his highest grossing film was Moonraker. His highest grossing film, Pro Rata, is actually his first entry. So it would have been easy for them to cut corners, and they very much don't. We're properly there in India.
Yeah, it's literally 100%. I do like these authentic locations.
Yeah. I never liked the way Vijay's sort of looking out the side of his eyes there, like he's a bit self-conscious.
Trying to keep an eye open, so.
Yeah.
I don't know, I find him a bit sort of cheesy in this film. He's a tennis star.
I don't like him in the film, but then in the next film, I mean, you could argue it's worse because you got two old men then, but I thought him and Patrick McNee went together better.
Yeah, they had a great chemistry.
And Patrick McNee wasn't trying to be like some sort of, you know, sidekick action man, was he? He was just there to help him maintain a cover.
So yeah, but it worked that he was a bit older.
He had wonderful chemistry.
I haven't got any problems like with anybody. I don't think, I just, obviously he's a bit, you know, he's a tennis star first, but.
Yeah, although I was rather brutal about it on the original show, but I would have thought if you were going to make a big thing of tennis in this, I would have thought he would have been like a real big name in tennis. And when I look back at his record, it was nothing that strong. He was a professional tennis player and he got to some Grand Slam quarters and things like that, but it wasn't a lot.
No, I think I knew him. I mean, it's Well, so you've got Wimbledon at the moment.
He guested in Star Trek 6, one of them.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was a. It was.
Or was it four?
Four.
Uh-huh.
It was four. It was like the one with the whales.
Right. Well, oh, I knew it was one of those where you saw modern day Starfleet not on the ship, all in their uniforms. So it had to be 3, 4, or 6, basically. And I couldn't remember. We noted it at the time when we did the episodes with Charlie all those years ago. Yeah.
I kind of miss like the Bond franchise actually going to different locations. Somehow recently it's not quite been the same.
Bond is named for glow popping, really, isn't he? So.
Since Craig, really, I'm not really sort of seeing.
Well,
really
they went to like Jamaica, was it? I think.
Yeah.
But then Cuba was shot on a stage, and then it was back over here again. Wasn't it?
I think the perceptions of travel have changed a lot as well. See, back in the 60s, package holidays were still very new, quite novel.
We're not expecting him to go down here to Torremolinos.
Torremolinos. He spent a night at 40 Towers.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when we last watched The War.
Benidorm.
There's a scene in, I think it's from Russia with Love. I wouldn't swear to it, but I think it's from Russia with Love where he sort of rings the desk and orders his breakfast and it's figs and all the rest of it. And they make such a big deal of that, yeah, because Bond hates tea. He does in the books as well. Books to come.
Well, he's wrong. I'm sorry.
I disagree with him on this, but there you go. But then his mother was sort of French anyway. But anyway.
Yeah,
What I was going to say was that would have been put in as something very exotic. Like, what's that he's ordering? I've never had that.
Exactly, yeah. Figs, Greek yogurt, coffee, very black. Now, it's not something...
Not everyone's tasted figs now, but we're not going to be overexcited by someone in a foreign country ordering some food we've not tried.
That's it. Yeah, some of those things, it's not really commonplace, is it?
It's something that I'd like to see in future films, to actually sort of see Bond as being a bit of a foodie.
Yeah, we don't get that very often as well, do we?
Or just like have sort of ordering eggs.
Being a snob, being such a snob.
Yeah.
Well, eggs are a big thing for him in the books. He loves his eggs.
Scrambled eggs. Yeah. Eggs Benedict. Also, we saw Albert Moses, obviously, that they used in the previous scene, but we've seen Albert Moses in Bond before, popping up as a barman in The Spy Who Loved Me.
I can't remember who that was we were looking at then.
Oh, no, it was a few scenes ago now.
Okay. I've lost track. And this is probably one of the films I'm least knowledgeable about. And as you can tell, I'm not ripping it apart tonight particularly, but it's just not a film I know supremely well.
I've seen it so many times.
I always liked her, and I'm surprised she doesn't get talked about more. She's very rarely discussed when people talk about Bond girls. I don't really know why.
Hey, Magda?
Yeah.
Is it because she's
overshadowed
by
Maud Adams? I mean, possibly, but... She wouldn't be the only secondary Bond girl to get into a conversation, would she?
I think to your original criticism, Dave, I think it's the part of the film where she's more prominent is probably the least memorable stuff. Yeah. And that's not a knock on her, it's just the film itself. It's not like a critique of her as an actress. It's just... Yeah. It's just she just happens to be in the more boring aspect of it.
Yeah, I guess so.
To be honest, as well, I mean, this is kind of like she was more known, at home sort of in Sweden, but this is like one of the biggest breakout roles for her in terms of over here, like American or UK cinema.
Yeah.
She kind of did Let's Have a Little Octopussy, obviously, played Greta Garbo famously as well. But then did what was IMDb say? Airwolf in the 80s, which was huge, Dallas, randomly. Sort of big, like, 80s sort of shows, but this is probably, like, quite a big launch pad for her, so.
You would have thought so. I mean, I don't know whatever else I've ever seen her in, actually, but...
Probably this, unfortunately.
I don't know, I'll have a look.
How do you think this portrays Khan here? Like, because I just, literally just had a thought now. With him being the one sort of having to cheat, doesn't it kind of make him a bit more of a petty kind of, like, why does he need to go around gambling, cheat, like, and cheating? It makes it sound like he's almost desperate for money.
Because Goldfinger's iconic. Goldfinger cheated at Cuz.
Also, well, yeah, Jax in Mirica as well is the same.
Yeah.
He's a bit of a card cheat.
Yeah.
I think it's just a general trope with villain, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess.
Chris, Dana Wayborn has not done that much. Not in English language anyway. She was in two episodes of Love Boat.
Oh, okay.
An episode of Werewolf, an episode of MacGyver, two episodes of Baywatch. I might watch that for research purposes. She doesn't seem to have a credit since 2010. That's Wikipedia, though. If I go to IMDb, there may be a little more sat behind it.
But we think of, like, Werewolf and...
And I don't know where she got the name Christina Wayborn, because she was born Britt Inger Johansson.
Well, there might have been another Britt Inger, we don't know. But I should have asked her about that, but we didn't, unfortunately.
A married name, I suppose. She's got 20 credits in total. One of those is a short film from 2010, and then you've got to go back 4 years, and then before that, another eight years.
And still, I think she's more well-known as a model as well.
That must be it, because she really hasn't done that much in acting.
I think that's quite a tense scene there between Bond and Khan. I mean, Louis Jordan is probably best known playing Dracula.
They monologue at each other too much these days, which is such a cliche. You know, history isn't kind to men who try to play God and things like that, and it's like they never actually used to do much of that. They did in the very earliest films, but then it kind of died away. It died off a little bit after a while. They used to just have these tense bits start opposite each other.
It was a bit of a trope.
Yeah.
Was that the
you and Curry line? We've just missed the keep you and actually keep
you and Curry.
Yeah,
I'll keep you and Curry. That's a bit embarrassing. Or maybe it comes a bit later on.
No, I think it's where he just really gave me the tip then.
And no, Mask is D'Artagnan, obviously. Monte Cristo. Oh.
Have you seen the newest Three Musketeers film?
No, I still want to see that because it's got Eva Green in it.
Well, that's why I went to see it for research purposes.
Yeah.
There's two as well, they've done two.
Another one's coming out at Christmas.
Another one's coming out. Well, it didn't get that wide of a release. I think it came out, it didn't even come out to any of the cinemas near here. But I think it had a much wider release in Europe, from what I gather, obviously.
Well, it's in French, yeah.
Yeah, obviously, but it didn't even come out to any. It was in, obviously, London, for example, but it didn't even come out.
Yeah, got it down here. Where I live. Got it down here. I can't find a home release version of it because I wanted to show it to my wife for the Christmas one because I said,
because
I enjoyed it. So I'm like, well, I'd like to go and see the second one, but of course I can't unless you see the first one, or I can't with you unless you see the first one.
Yeah, I really wanted to see it, so. Well, hopefully it'll come out.
Well, it's coming out on disc next month, but I can't see like in a digital release yet.
On disc.
Yeah. But I liked it.
On Laserdisc.
And she just doesn't age. It was her birthday about 3 days ago. She's in her 40s now. She just doesn't age. She's still the fucking sort of sex kitten.
Yeah, she still looks the
film.
Same.
Yeah. She's still like the character's still sort of using her feminine wiles and stuff.
This is why Bond girls are forever, you know.
Yeah. Rupia, I remember.
Yeah, that's the one. That got for hard currency. Oh. Then I got for market.
Gotta have the reaction. Oh, you've got a tennis joke.
Yeah. I think that one's quite funny. It's like earlier that we saw in the scene when they were going up to the hotel. He's like, oh, what else have you learned? He's like, oh, my background's improved.
Well, he could have been a porn star, couldn't he? They could have all been getting splattered on the way
that's
past.
Quite a funny line. There we go.
Rupia.
Camels. Camels everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, actually, he's not terrible, but I just didn't like him that much in the film, RVJ. And he didn't go on to do that much either, in acting, I mean. And I always thought he looked a bit uncomfortable in this. I've seen some candid shots from the day they shot this, because I'm sure I've seen sort of Roger sat offset dressed like that with that round his neck.
I'm trying to keep a lookout for Mark Heap because I think he appears in these scenes somewhere.
Okay.
Well, he's got Blink and You Miss Him, I think.
I don't even know if I know him.
When the background artist. He was in Big Train, Friday Night.
That Mark Heap?
Yeah, that Mark Heap.
You mean Brian from Spaced?
Yeah. He's in this as a background artist.
He can't have been very old.
No, I think he was. Yeah, I think he was like 20 or so. Oh, there he is. Yeah, he's the guy who throws the fire. Obviously, in heavy makeup.
I did not.
I don't think I did. It was him until you guys pointed out.
You said Mark Heap, and I swear I nearly went. what, from space? And then I thought, I must
yeah,
have the name.
There must be some other,
Last, for viewers who don't know what on earth we're talking about, because space was a quarter of a century ago now, Friday Night Dinner, the neighbour who's scared of his dog? That's Mark Heap. For something a bit more recent. But I first encountered him in space as, like, again, another neighbour, but he was a neighbour who was like an artist. Yeah. That's Mark Heap.
There's stuff like Big Train and things like that.
And he's had small parts in the Edgar Wright's films as well. If you look at the bar in which they meet Brosnan, he's working the bar in there, and I think something similar in Hot Fuzz. Yeah.
See, now I've seen it, I can't unsee it.
Yeah. Now he's there, you can't unsee.
Yeah, okay.
It's just got that that lanky sort of
Yeah, he was in the background,
he's very, very tall.
Yeah, he is very tall, very thin then.
I can just sort of like see,
Because I remember looking him up when he was in Spaced, and he was a hell of a lot older than I realised. Because Brian's in that show's got a very young air to him.
Mm-hmm. He does,
But the character was born, the actor was born in the late 50s or something. So he was like my age now then. Even here, I mean, it's just the type of sort of sexuality. I mean, Sean was always like, would always take it if it came his way, but like pointing the camera at tits and stuff like that. Like, you do think, like, grow up, you know what I mean?
I don't like that scene where, was it, I can't remember if it's this one or Moonraker. No, it's this one, isn't it? I think, honestly, they showed the liquid crystal.
The close up of the tits.
Yeah, I just think, no.
That's here.
That's just, very cringeworthy.
It would be all right if I found it funny. Now, humour's completely subjective, but everyone said he was the funny Bond, and I'm like, I didn't laugh that often.
it's just very cute.
And I mean it. It sounds like I'm being contrarian, because he's seen as so serious now, and actually, by the end, I did feel sorry for Daniel Craig's Bond.
No.
But in Casino Royale, I laughed out loud 5 or 6 times. And I've never ever laughed that many times at a Roger Moore film. I don't think I laughed.
Was it Jeremy Bullock as Smith is appearing again?
I don't think I laughed at that many times at his entire run. Yeah.
It's quite funny as well. Another sort of JBR connection, because under lockdown, one of our group turned 50, and Octopussy was his favourite film, I think.
Fair enough.
And so some of us took turns to we sort of chose scenes to film, and we split off into little groups.
Mm.
So I got to play.
What, you got to do close-ups of your tits for him, did you?
I did. I think I played Rubovich, Bond.
Okay.
And somebody else. I had 3 parts to play.
All right.
I played the chairman during the meeting as well. So, during the all-off meeting.
Awesome.
So, I was Bond, Rubovich and chairman to go and sit down, both of you.
Remember when digital watches were massive as a big thing? They were, new.
That was very 80s.
Yeah.
That's not classic watches at the time.
Were fancy.
They were luxury.
Yeah,
I remember
were,
I was taught to tell the time.
And,
right? And then I went out, and my mum said to my dad, they were separated by then, and she said, can you buy him a watch? And he bought me a digital one. I didn't know how the fuck they worked.
Because
I'd learnt on an analogue watch. But
Some of them were quite technical, didn't they? They had a calculator.
No, I don't mean I don't know how the watch worked. I mean, I didn't know how to tell the time in digital. I've been taught it on a clock face.
Yeah, no, I meant watches.
I mean, I was reasonably smart. It only took me 5 minutes for my mum to explain the difference. Well, that means that on a digital watch. Yeah.
But some of them had quite a lot of other things built in.
That is some fast stitching work. He's only just handed that over.
Well, she works quickly.
She looks quite unconcerned. Her tits are on TV. Has she not looked around and noticed yet at all?
Maybe she doesn't know. Oh, yeah. Oh, fabulous.
Sure, Roger's on the breast of it.
Yeah.
Oh, well done.
Yeah. Your table is ready. Okay.
You didn't reserve them well. Mr. Bond.
Yeah, but bear with us, you might get a shag out of it.
Bear with it, it might be with Christina Weyborn. I think she's definitely underrated, but she's quite an enigmatic character because we don't really know too much about her. Obviously, she's Octopussy Girl, she's a sort of smuggler, she's also a gymnast, also an acrobat.
Actually, looking at her in this scene, it's funny
she's
we were talking about last night in Soho, because when you look at Anya Taylor-Joy, She's unusual looking, and her eyes are a little bit too far apart and stuff, but she's still attractive in her way.
She's beautiful. And like,
Christina Weyborn's got an unusual look as well. She's kind of striking.
No, she, yeah, I think she's beautiful, definitely.
Yeah. And I don't ask me why, but I've never liked white tux jackets. Don't like them. I was really pissed off when Craig put one on. It's like, oh, fucking leave that shit alone.
I think... I'm sorry, but Sean wore it better. I mean, a stylist of Rogelik's.
Yeah, I'm still not fond. I'm just not fond of the white tuxes. I don't like them. I wouldn't wear one.
I think there was one of the... I can't remember which premiere it was. I want to say Spectre, perhaps. I think Tom Sears wore the white one. And
it was Spectre.
Chris Kamers with a double-breasted suit.
Yeah, but I don't think you're an idiot to wear one. It's just a matter of taste, that's all.
No, not at all. Yeah, they both look very stylish. Very stylish chaps, as they always do.
Let's go on making a few. For a scrapbook... What, was she going to put the condom wrapper in there or something?
She'll take his photo. We did try to ask her about a scrapbook, but she wasn't very
Why do people start undressing so far from the bed and then just work their way slowly towards it? It never, I don't know, they never sort of get right to the bed and then just dump them all there.
Part of the allure.
Yeah. It's the one thing Michael McIntyre ever said that I agreed with. He said, they said, at what point do you know you're in a committed relationship? And it's the part where it's the point where you start undressing yourself, right? When you're undressing each other, it's still a fling. At the point where you start taking your own clothes off, it's a relationship.
Oh dear.
I can also confirm that there is joke about sort of like having kids as comparison to couples who don't have kids is absolutely spot on.
I don't know that joke. Or I may have heard it.
It's basically sort of like saying like, oh, you know, you couples who are watching, you have no idea. You think, oh, well, no, we'd love to have a child. It's like you have no idea what it's like.
Yeah.
It's like. It just makes jokes like sort of you're driving down, you're sort of, oh, there's that new restaurant, we could go anytime.
Yeah.
in comparison to like having kids, which you're like, we'll never go.
We'll never go there.
Yeah.
The only thing that annoys me with Louis Jourdan is the way you pronounce octopussy.
Octopussy.
Octopussy. It's like he doesn't really speak English at all and he's learnt it phonetically or something.
He's learnt it, yeah.
I think he probably just enjoys saying it.
Yeah, I know. I was watching the amount of fucking hair products that must have been used in this decade. No wonder there was a hole in the ozone layer. I was watching, it was on Netflix the other day. It was a documentary about Wham. Right.
Oh yeah, apparently that's really good.
And it finishes with The Final, which is their last concert at Wembley Stadium in 1986. And you get reactions of the audience, and there's just so much hair, and it's so well coiffed. I'm thinking the amount of hairspray. You know, if someone lit a cigarette, Wembley Stadium would go up like a fucking match with the amount of hairspray in that crowd. She's like, no, you've had it. That's it. Lands and breaks her neck. That's the end of the film.
Yeah, that is quite a very dangerous sort of thing to do.
And now she's just getting in just her pants. He seems quite relaxed about it, but I've got a shack out of it, I don't care. I'll just go home and tell Em I failed. No, I just started. We're getting ready for Casino Royale, so I'm just doing... I'm alternating between the Nobody Does It Better audio book, which is about 30 odd hours of it, and Forever in a Day, which is obviously effectively a retrofitted prequel to Casino Royale that came out about 3 or 4 years ago, and it's really good. It does fit sort of nicely. The only thing is there's a few continuity errors the Fleming estate should have picked up, but apart from that it does play like a lost Fleming. Once again, I suppose this happens a lot in Bond films. Eva Green doesn't appear for maybe an hour, but yeah, Octopussy takes a long time to make an entrance in this film.
I do like how they do tie it in with the actual short story.
I'm trying to remember the short story. I've read it, but I don't remember it.
It basically is like just it's.
I thought you were reading them in order, by the way. How have you read Octopussy?
Well, no, I know the story of
Octopussy. Oh, do you?
All right. So I've read the kind of like the basic plot of them.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, it's quite short. It's
I've read them all, but I don't remember the short story very well. I'm about to go to have a look at it now and see what I can remember.
Well, basically, like it's basically the story that she tells, like, "Oh, what you did for my dad."
Ah.
In other words, like,
yeah, it's a story of
in other words,
with the gold. Yeah. Yes, it was.
Yeah, so basically,
yeah, it goes into Ismai's backstory.
You allowed him to sort of die his way and kind
okay,
of like.
Okay, so Octopussy is a sequel to Octopussy. Cool.
Yeah.
I remember some of the short stories. I remember The Living Daylights very, very well.
It does. It's basically a flashback.
The Property of a Lady is The Property of a Lady from this, more or less. Quantum of Solace is really good. The Hildebrand Rarity is largely a little bit like... It's sort of... Bits of it are used in License to Kill. I don't remember them all. From a View to a Kill is nothing like the story.
No, that's completely different.
Completely different. But it's funnily enough, you've named the one I didn't really remember too well.
Wikipedia says, "Yeah, the two original stories, Octopussy and Living Daylights, are both adapted to publication and a comic strip format." First, Octopussy, starring Roger Moore as James Bond, was the backstory for the film Octopussy, whilst The Property of a Lady was more closely adapted for the auction sequence, obviously, as we know. Living Daylights.
Have I got this right? Is Quantum of Solace the story he's told about the married couple and the woman who was a cheat and everything else? Was that Quantum of Solace?
I think so.
Because I liked that. It was a really unusual little story. And Bond is just listening to it.
Yeah, because he does receive his Quantum of Solace, his little, you know.
But Becca will have gone through the books many, many more times than me. I mean, we're about to do Casino Royale, and I suspect I've read that 3 or 4 times. But some of the later ones I've just done like once.
It's one of those literary classics, isn't it? I think it's kind of up there with, like...
But it goes first as well.
Sense of Sensibility and Great Expectations and all those for me, as far as I'm concerned.
The strongest thing about...
the modern era.
The biggest compliment I can pay Casino Royale is, like, the strongest books... I've got two compliments really. The first one is that it both evokes the films and makes you forget the films at the same time, in that it gives you everything you love about the classic Bond, but is just different enough that you could see it as its own thing and enjoy it on its own merits. But I would also say that his best books, you cannot wait to pick the next one up. I can't think of an author who finishes books as well as Ian Fleming. The last 30-40 pages of Casino Royale, you just can't let it go, and you're like, here we go, and you want to pick up the next one. They're not high art, I wouldn't say that, but Christ, are they propulsive. And they're very evocative as well. You can see why it worked as a series, although ironically, James Bond, the literary character, is not even that likable, really.
I don't think it's not meant to be though. I think
no,
it's
but
not,
you,
not
you
really
see,
meant to be a likeable
because
character.
Because you're following from his perspective, you do end up rooting for him. You're still on his side.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So it's not that he's someone you'll hate, but
yeah, he's not. Quite, he wasn't written to be a likeable character.
He hasn't got the nicest traits. This is why when everyone says, "Oh, literary Bond is Dalton." Dalton's way fucking too nice to be the literary Bond. Craig is closer because Craig's not actually that fucking nice.
Oh no, it's the sheep egg. It's the sheep's head. Sheep's eyes.
Oh yeah, George Lucas watching this going, we could do something
George
like this.
Monkey brains.
Yeah.
Did this come out before?
Yes.
Or after
Temple of Doom? Temple of Doom was the following year.
Yeah. I don't know what's more gross, sheep's eyes or monkey brains. Apologies to any culture who do either of those.
Anything
I mean,
eyes,
Indies,
I would think.
Indies meant to be sort of heavily influenced by Bond.
But I mean, so. I've eaten brain in Romania. I'll share a link just with you guys on the page about a restaurant in Romania. Everything about that restaurant will be in Romanian, but you'll see some of the pictures and stuff like that. and you get various parts of the sheep, including brain. And it's I didn't have a problem with it at all, because if it's widely eaten in a culture, I'm like, yeah, I'll give it a try.
Well, so yeah, personally, I probably wouldn't eat it just because of vegetarianism. But I think it's quite good that they use
all eyes. I might be a little bit more reluctant.
I'm sure they're very good.
This was the oldest restaurant in the city. It was like opened in something like 1789 or something.
Wow, cool. How about that?
And historic. You sit outside and just eat and drink these platters of food and some of the beers and stuff. And it's really nice.
Sounds fabulous.
Yeah, I've had break, but I've never eaten eyeballs, and I'm not saying I wouldn't, but it doesn't really appeal. But I've eaten testicles.
I've eaten alligator, not a whole one, but a little bit of one.
And it also had Cara's vagina on the plate.
Ooh.
And I was told how succulent it was, and I was joking through an interpreter. I said, they've given me the party cow. And they said, what do you mean? I said, this girl's been busy, because this is as tough as old boots. I couldn't eat it.
Oh my god, really?
Yeah.
Nice barbecue sauce.
Yeah.
I think that that's, you know, it's good we've wasted a lot of food in this country, but obviously in other cultures, they like to use, like, the whole animal. Obviously, like, if you go to some sort of Asian, these sort of
some Asian of them,
countries, obviously they use, like, chicken feet, things like that.
Yeah.
Parts.
A Chinese supermarket in the town that sells chicken feet.
Or the kind of parts of, you know, that otherwise we wouldn't perhaps eat in Western.
You can make a soup with them.
Yeah, you can. Good soup, yeah. It's very popular, it is too.
Yeah.
You know, use the whole animal if you can, why not? But yeah. I would probably be rude, unfortunately, in
decline. This is a bit nylon safari suit, isn't it?
This is the Bond safari suit, isn't it?
I don't know why they put him in that. It's not flattering.
It's probably baking hot as well in the hot Indian sun.
Yeah. It's not flattering at all.
Ooh, pervert Bond.
Yeah,
I never noticed that pervert scene before.
No, but he is in every scene. The only bit that was funny was when she said
pervy,
the only funny bit was where he said he needed a she said she needed a refill, and he did kind of like pause, like what does she mean? Oh, a drink, right?
Yeah, the fact that she was undressing, I just feel that's a bit like.
Do we get a bird fly out here or anything? Because that was the John Glenn thing, wasn't it?
Probably.
Yeah, birds. It's a John Glenn trick.
He was a fine director. It's a pity he got his hands on it when it was all a little tired, and like Binder wasn't at his best, and so on.
I think he injected new energy into the series.
I just think if he'd got it in a more timeless classic era than the, you know, than the late 70s
well,
onwards,
like,
were.
I mean, you look at like License to Kill, and that's like. I mean, you would think that would be a completely different director stepped in and did that, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's always interesting to me sort of how different sort of how directors work. But I don't know. I think it's just down to the body he had at the time. You know. You know,
telling things like "There's only so much I could do with Rogers Bond." I mean, he never said anything outwardly rude, and I think that's the mark of the man. I don't think either of them would slag off other people, but I did get the impression that at least when he got Tim, he was like, right, I can put my stamp on this now. And he did more so in Tim's second entry. And I think that's because a lot of the Living Daylights was written before they knew who was playing Bond. They tend to write them a little bit neutral, which is probably why it reminds me of For Your Eyes Only, because yours For Your Eyes Only was written as in, we're not sure who Bond is, let's just write it a bit straighter than...
Mm.
You don't get as much silliness as you do with most Roger Moore entries after the first couple anyway. His first couple were pretty straight and solid.
Mm. Plus, also after Moonraker, he had to kind of ground it a bit.
Nowhere else to go, was there? But I still wholeheartedly like that film. There's some silly jokes in it I hate, but For Your Eyes Only is a fine film. I can't even remember. What is their plot, Izzy? What is it they're trying to do, Becca?
What's that, this film?
Yeah, what are they trying to achieve here?
Basically smuggling jewellery.
Yeah, but there's more to it than that, surely.
Yeah, they to finance... global war. I think it's trying to finance his plan to march on Europe, basically.
So a little bit like the Living Daylights.
Similarly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but it's kind of like Cold War, kind of like
yeah.
Cold War shenanigans.
I know. Yeah, but a bit like a bit like in The Living Daylights, he's presented as Russian, but he's rogue, and he's doing his own thing.
He's a rogue agent.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, he wants to instigate a war to for his agenda, and the one is just, well, I'm going to
get rich
off the back of it.
Now, you think...
Use it as cover. You know,
you'd think Gabinda would come across as a real classic villain to me, but he doesn't make much impression on me. I think Gabinda's really bland.
What?
He doesn't really have a lot of dialogue.
He doesn't have a lot to do. He just looks so stern, doesn't he? Well, I mean, Oddjob had no dialogue, but...
No, he's quite imposing, though. I think, he's quite underrated. I think even though he has, like, dinner at 8 o'clock... Well, yes, Excellency, yes, very minimal dialogue.
I think it may just be he doesn't get enough to do.
He's just a tall guy. He's got no...
he's very tall, very imposing.
He's got no, like...
he's not that bulky, is he?
Presence of for himself. Do you know what I mean? He's...
No. I think the series was a little bit on autopilot at this point. The Cold War had been going a very, very long time. They had to check in with it every now and again because it was so big in the world. And the villains are a little bit rinse and repeat. They come from different parts of the world, but they've got similar traits, and the henchmen have similar traits. And yeah, there you go. I'm never quite sure how much I like Kamel Khan. I like the card sequence. I forgot about those two.
What, the knife throwing act?
Mm, yeah.
Well, they're more memorable.
Yeah.
As henchmen.
Let's have a look. See what's in this book. Let's have a look.
Have you got a copy of the book there, have you?
I've got a copy here. I'm just trying
tell
to
tell us about it then. I was lucky to
meet Delsing, who was
the
servant.
Let's do a bit of shilling for Mark. I think Mark either listens to the show. We're certainly friends with him anyway. I think he might listen.
Hi, Mark. He really enjoyed our Indiana Jones.
Oh, did he? Good evening, Mark. Tell us about his book.
Just having a little look. Just trying to find some stories about
Gabinda,
basically.
So are you saying you haven't been asked to read it yet? Now you've got to make some shit up because we're online.
No, I've got it. I have read it from cover to cover, definitely.
Okay.
Let's have a look. So yeah, obviously he was Delsing, who's lovely, really fun gentleman. He did an amazing DJ set as well, which is very cool. Was like chief turpentine for Gabinda during the film. Let's have a look. And it was quite interesting because basically... I think he was due to wear, Biddy was due to wear like a completely different costume, but they did it all to kind of to tie in, sorry, pun intended, to match the turban that he wore. Ended up kind of making him look a lot better.
So is it just about locations for Octopussy, and is it just about the train?
Yes, lots of different things really. It's all about the history of the Nene Valley Railway, how it got started, and obviously because it's a well-preserved heritage railway, definitely. It's all behind the scenes from the cast and crew, from the volunteers and the staff of Nene Valley.
More widely. I feel guilty now, he's listening to a film I don't like much. But there you go, show it. But yeah, okay.
It's okay, yeah, no worries. Let's have a look. Yes, he was obviously trying to tie this tie. And Del says, I said to Kabir, you're a tall guy, so it really sets your turban off. You need a little bit what sets you off the rest of it. And we did that. All the costume people were saying it looked really smart because it went with his size, because he's quite a tall guy.
Yeah.
So he says also, for an Indian guy, Kabir was quite unique because he had piercing blue eyes and quite light features. So with a grey turban, he looked really, really good. Otherwise, he would look like a matchstick. He says, working with the main henchman in Bond film was a memorable experience for Del. Del says, Kabir was lovely, a really down-to-earth guy. He started off life in Bollywood, but he made that transition across. He'd made an Italian series called Sandokan Pirate, where he'd come to prominence. But obviously only found out about his career after he'd told us. He was really polite, very modest. And admitted this was the probably biggest film that he got. It obviously worked for him, as it gave him a springboard into America with Dynasty.
He was in Dynasty? Gabinda, we're talking about?
Apparently so, yep.
Right, let me look him up.
I'd say that then probably is probably the biggest sort of known films that they kind of worked on. But it's one of those another instances where obviously I think he's quite sort of fearsome. Like if I was to be honest, like if he'd been able to attend this event, I would be like quite scared of him because his character's quite
imposing. Don't know, do you? You don't know how he looks these days.
But apparently like he's, because I did ask Del, I said, you know, what was it like working with him? Because he's quite a scary character. He doesn't say much, but he's quite imposing and he gives quite a piercing stare. And he says, oh no, he's a big pussycat. He's lovely. And obviously
now, I'm seeing photos of him in later stuff, and there's nothing scary about him at all.
No, that's it. I'm sure he's lovely. But
which suggests he's actually pretty good at what he does. Yeah.
But I bet he'd be lovely.
He seems to be doing stuff back in his native lands now.
Yeah, I think he wasn't able to attend the Neen Valley because he was doing a book signing in Spain or somewhere.
Yeah.
And I think there was also the new fan club that's opened up, 007GB. They had an event this weekend aboard HMS Belfast on Saturday.
Now, he was in 75 episodes of The Bold and the Beautiful.
Oh, right. I don't think I've ever seen that.
That sounds like American daytime soap, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
He was in one episode of Team Knight Rider. He was in the Highlander television series. Are you sure he was in Dynasty? I haven't got to that yet. Magnum P.I. Beverly Hills Bunce. Do you know what that was? They tried to spin off Hill Street Blues into the Bunce character, which was Dennis Franz. Dennis Franz before he did NYPD Blue. He was in an episode of Murder, She Wrote. Stingray. 1987, that can't be the same.
That's what it's in the Mark's book, that's what I just got to go by.
The original Knight Rider. I think you've got the soaps maybe mixed up, but yeah.
That's what Mark said in his book, I'm sorry.
Well, it's not on IMDb, that's all.
No, that's fine.
But that doesn't mean he isn't correct.
Well, this is it.
And this is as an actor. I mean, what I'm not sure about whether he did, he might have done something
back. Mark's book is very well researched, so I'm just going by what's in the book, I'm afraid.
He was a writer and additional crew and stuff as well.
Yeah, so you don't know.
Yeah,
so obviously he's very... He was an Anita and Me. Wow.
Additional crew. Okay, videos.
Kismet, classic film Kismet.
And
he was named after Kismet.
And he starred in West End musical adaptation of MMK's Far Pavilions at the Shaftesbury Theatre in 2005.
Wow.
So he's actually done stage musicals.
Yeah. He was in Stingray, but not that Stingray.
No, not in 1987. No. We've just missed the Tarzan yell.
Oh.
I just think that sometimes they couldn't help themselves. And I just felt like if they'd stood back and just asked themselves one question, they might have... stop themselves. And what I mean by that is, if they'd stood back and just gone, who would find this funny? Who is this aimed at?
The thing is, though, I think probably people would have said, yeah, I would have, yeah, I love that.
Really?
At the time. Yeah, I think if you did, the feedback loop they would have got would have been, yeah, this is, yeah, people like this. People expect this kind of, like, this kind of humour.
All right.
Expecting it
and finding it funny is a different thing, although I have to say this line is funny that's coming up now.
Well, I think it's just, you know,
I just think it was those goofy things. It reminds me, George Lucas's humour was a little bit like that in some of the Star Wars film, where, you know, the things you laugh at aren't funny, it's more the idea of it than the execution. This is funny though. No, ma'am, on with the economy tour is a funny line.
That's one of my favourite lines in the film. No, the economy tour.
Yeah, it's kind of.
I'd
like,
normally lost if, interest by this point, so I don't think I'd noticed that line for a long time. But it is funny.
It's kind of along the lines of No Ticket in Indiana Jones.
It is very. But yeah, Tarzan yells and stuff like that. I just think have a word with yourself. You know, there are ways to be funny without just being goofy. Hey, I wonder if he's getting a massage. I wonder if he'll get a happy ending.
Does Holly need the bathroom? Daddy, let me out.
So this is the...
He's very cute.
This is, I think we saw this on the wall in Die Another Day.
The alligator, yeah, what do you reckon?
I'm not quite...
costume.
I love the fact he's got a windscreen on it. I never really noticed that before. I don't know. Again, is it meant to be funny? Is it meant to be a... I don't know. I don't think it's... I don't think it's a fantastic visual or joke, but it's okay. But then, you know, Sean Connery, you know, was wearing a dinner jacket under something similar.
Yeah, that pigeon, didn't you?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's not out of keeping for the series. And I think occasionally particularly if you're not a Roger fan, it's easy to sort of hang things on him that actually other Bonds would have done as well. Roger Moore appeared in 7 of these, but that mole on his face only appeared in 6. He has plastic surgery before the next film.
He did have it removed, didn't he?
And I don't know why they dressed. He's dressed here like he's about to go on Country File. He just looks like he's about to present with John Craven.
But he does it with such casuality.
Yeah. I don't know what they were thinking sometimes with this. So Maud Adams finally. Beautiful woman, very underrated in The Man with the Golden Gun, I thought. And I thought she looked beautiful in that film. I think she's a bit too 80s in her hair here. But it's sort of nice to see her back. I think I'm right in saying she was Roger's favourite leading lady. He was asked about it on his various tours, and I can only imagine he would give variations of the same answer, unless he was genuinely forgetful, which I don't believe he was. And he was asked who his favourite leading lady was, and he said Maud Adams without a moment's hesitation. I think he loved working with her. She always reminds me a little bit of Lois Charles in looks. Just a little bit.
Well, it's there's a similar kind of like, hair shape,
similar shape of face, yeah. Anyway, enough of this drinking. It must be time to milk the cows. This is the story you're on about Becca, and I need to read it again, and we'll cover it, or we will do all the books at some point. Unless we get 3 in and Chris is like, I don't like this, I'm really struggling, we'll try and do them all at some point.
No, I mean, to be fair, like with the Flemings, they do kind of, I mean, there's probably one or two that go on a little bit, and
I think they ebb and flow.
To be fair, they're quite relatively short, and they do kind of whip along at a good pace.
They average about 250 pages.
Some of them, I think the first, because I'm also part of an Instagram Bond book club, and I think obviously the first year we did it under lockdown, we went through all the Flemings, and then the subsequent years we've gone through and kind of maybe done some continuation novels or books that kind of remind us of Fleming, or like some of the non-fiction. Like, for example, we did one of Raymond Benson's books. We had him on the show, which is really good.
Awesome.
Not our show, but in our group. And then the next one that we're doing in our group is Reflections of Death, so the Dynamite comics. But yeah, so I think it's probably been...
The comics look good. I haven't really done any of them, though. They look good.
Yeah, check them out. Highly recommend them, definitely.
I love the art style.
Amazing. And they really kind of... There's quite hard edge to them. I'd recommend maybe not reading them to your children. But
the early books are kind of... It gets a bit more mixed later on. But the early books are kind of almost enjoyed alternate entries. Like, I liked the first one, then I didn't like the second one, then I loved the third one, then I didn't really like the fourth one, and so it went on.
I do find the Octopussy henchwomen costumes a bit too much.
Is it The Greatest American Hero, or whatever it's called? That guy who was in... that guy was in Carrie as a superhero. I've got to look at the costume because it reminds me of that. It looks vaguely superhero-ish. It's really odd.
It just screams like sort of like a Star Trek episode where they landed on the planet women.
Oh yeah. Google image search The Greatest American Hero.
I'd rather not.
And you'll see it's nothing crude there. I promise you. And you'll see exactly what I mean. And it's not something I've ever watched. I saw a photo of it years ago, but it sticks in your head. Google image search Greatest American Hero. And you'll see the blonde guy from Carrie. And it reminds me of the outfits in this.
Yeah, it's pretty much.
Yeah. Never seen that show. I just know of it. Here's a publicity still of your enemy. And I remember the first time I ever saw that, like, or the first time I remember seeing that sort of buzzsaw thing, thinking, well, they can't kill Bond with it, so I bet VJ dies that way. And I was right, and I was only a child when I saw it. Yeah, because I just thought it was a bit obvious.
I thought it's a bit weird that, like, it's not, obviously it's quite an iconic moment in the film, but it's not something that Gawinda does. Like, he doesn't use it. Like, obviously Odd Job had his bowler hat.
Yeah.
Jaws has his teeth.
Yeah.
Gawinda, obviously, he has a stare down, and he's quite handy with a scimitar.
I think the problem is he served his purpose now. What are we watching now?
Him and Connor matching
you
as well.
You don't really need him in the film anymore, so you got to get rid of him. And I think it's one of those things that's come up in script development, and it's a bit messy. I could almost imagine there was a draft of this where they almost forgot about him, or forgot to off him, or forgot to get rid of him, and then they're like, well, what about VJ? It feels like a bit of a hasty rewrite. I might be completely wrong on that. But yeah, I don't know what he went on to do. He made some quarterfinals in tennis, and that was about it. And we saw him in Star Trek, but he didn't, at least a few years ago when we looked, he didn't have many credits at all. VJ, camera charge. Yeah. He's filled out a little bit with age. Let's have a look. He is a leading tennis commentator for Fox Sports in the US and Star TV in Asia, and his California-based company, even that's a fucking pun, First Serve Entertainment, is one of the leading multimedia production companies that deals with Asian-American content and helped Disney, Turner, and ESPN enter the Indian market. So that answers the point, really. He's not an actor. He had 9 credits. His last one was 2001. Not the film 2001, the year 2001. And I always struggle to remember her role in this and what she's being used for.
Yeah, she's basically the front, isn't she?
Yeah.
The smuggling operation. So.
Okay.
I think she's quite, you know, obviously, one girls, one women, they get like a rough time. But I think she's, especially for the 80s as well, you kind of got like, obviously, Vita Kuo mentioned women's lib, like, you know, in America as well. But, you know, she's kind of, yes, she's a diamond smuggler, but, you know, she's also an athlete as well. But she, you know, she tells Bond, but I've diversified shipping, hotels. Mm. You know, she's a businesswoman first and foremost. She owns her own properties. You know, she's got a team, she's got a business.
But it's been bollocks all the way through the series, though. We'll get a Bond girl come along and they'll say, finally, a match for Bond. How many times have you heard that cliche?
I know.
They've had agency right the way through the series.
Only not to be. So.
Honey Rider was a bit childlike, and she is in the book as well. Tatiana, you could debate, but I mean, Pussy Galore had tons of agency.
Exactly.
You'll get the odd clunky one, because I think Domino was a bit bland and a bit easy to dominate.
Even people like, you know, like during the Bosn era, like Jinx, Wei Lin, for example, you know, they're quite tough women, they can hold their own, they're agents.
Well, Wei Lin was more talented than Bond in that film.
They still have to be rescued, they still have to be, you know, saved by Bond, and the same here, you know.
Well, that's
like,
a set. That is definitely
still,
a set.
Bond still seduces Octopussy. I mean, yeah, you know, successful businesswoman, also a criminal, but also gets seduced by Bond, or, you know, she tries to seduce him.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. But,
like, for example, it's also the anniversary of Live and Let Die, which had its premiere, at London premiere this week, 50 years ago. And, you know, how refreshing at the time it was for Bond to be turned down, like Rosie, obviously, African-American woman, to turn Bond down. So,
right, he still had
shock
her.
Horror for the time.
But he still had her. That's not actually that.
Well, he did, but she declined, first of all.
Yeah.
So.
But, and of course, we're 60 years from Russia with Love as well.
Yes. I mean, yeah, some Bond girls are kind of fed better, but that's why I kind of think No Time to Die was so refreshing, to have somebody like Paloma, who, even though she only spends like 10 minutes on screen, which is a great shame. And, like, you know, doesn't... She saves Bond's ass, pretty much. doesn't need to be rescued by him. And likewise, Naomi as well. She saves Madeline and Matilda off the island. Doesn't need to be seduced or anything.
I've got so much feelings about it now because I don't want... Brosnan is shorthand for what I'm trying to say. I'm not having a go at Brosnan particularly. But I don't want that era back where they were kind of disposable and written in a bit of a hurry and a bit crap every couple of years. And they did all right, but they weren't really achieving anything but spinning their wheels. I like the fact the Craig era tried something new, but I would actually like to see Bond enjoy himself a bit more.
Yeah, I think the Craig films definitely are a bit dour. A little bit.
Well, the first couple were all right. They just started navel-gazing from the third one on.
Yeah, that's kind of where my sort of controversial take is. I think as popular Skyfall is, I think that's probably the ultimate ruinous Bond movie.
Though if he'd stopped at Skyfall, everyone would say what a great run that was. All right, Quantum weren't perfect, but I like Skyfall more now than I used to. But I definitely think it took the Bond era, it took his era in the wrong direction.
You know what really went wrong with it is the kind of whole the Q scene with the like exploding pen. We don't really go for that. We don't go for that anymore. Right? Which basically kind of shits on GoldenEye essentially. But then, but in the same movie, you got jizzing over like the vintage DB5 or all the gadgets.
Yeah,
and that.
So
like,
it was very fan servicey, but it was also Bond started. The Bond series started to spend all its time justifying its own existence. Do we need a 00 section? Is it outdated? Are you a relic? Are you outdated? Nothing to do with age, in my opinion, but just about, is the Bond series still relevant? And then we can't just have him half-heartedly shagging women, you know, and sort of enjoying it, because that's sexist. So, yes, he can sleep around, but he's got to have a bit of a tough life. He's got to pay for his pleasures. And I just think, like, by the end, I loved Daniel Craig in the role. I really do, still. But I just thought the entries were starting to get progressively worse, and they were taking it away from the promise it had to start with. The first two entries were exactly what I wanted, and they were more Fleming-esque than anyone has ever really seemed to admit, because the Bond is not that likeable a guy, and the Bond in Casino Royale wasn't. And they started trying to like humanise him and have him agonise about stuff, and it's like, can we have Bond just enjoy himself a bit? You can still have character development. You don't have to go back to it being Brosnan, you know, you beat my time, and wow, I'm the best at everything I ever attempt. You don't have to go that far. You can still have him get cut, you can still have him get hurt, but like, show him taking some pleasures in something. She's thinking, I've had him.
Had enough.
Yeah,
you know, if I think, yeah, with the deconstruction era, it's always been a bit.
That's my problem with
like
India as
navel gazing.
Yeah. My problem with India as well. It's like they're just not wish fulfillment anymore because, you know, woe betide they have any fucking fun because it's either seen as too shallow, or it's seen as like not punishing them for their foibles. I suppose I don't know. And the thing is, I'm on board with it to a degree. I thought the Brosnan era, for example, was quite dreadfully thin. So to try to put a bit more meat on the bones is fine. But by the time you get to the end film, I remember there's a sequence where he first meets what turns out to be his daughter. And he says, you know, I wanted everything with you and everything and stuff like that. And I'm sat there thinking, we're with like this secret agent all British boys wanted to be at one point in their life, and I'm feeling sorry for him, and I'm thinking something's gone wrong here. And by the end of the Indiana Jones film, I was fucking depressed, you know. And I just think like there's got to be a balance, and they haven't found it yet. It isn't take it back to Brosnan or Moore. It isn't that there's a middle ground they haven't struck yet. Casino Royale was there because I laughed plenty at that film. And although he had a tough time at the end of the film because of what happens to Vesper, there was plenty about that film that like I thought he was enjoying. You know, yeah. He did enjoy the little warm-up card games where he ripped off that bloke and shagged his wife. And, you know, I thought they had it right for the grittier end of the Bond spectrum. That's how you do it.
I mean, the things that you can do, like fast and loose, kind of like breezy, kind of like tone, but with shades of grittiness, shades of grit.
Yeah.
You can't have anything you want. You know, it is doable. You just have to sort of stay true to.
Just don't agonize
over it. The actor you have.
Yeah, and so the Craig version was never going to be happy-go-lucky, and I'm all right with that. Yeah, I'm okay with them not being happy-go-lucky. I get that. I'm not even quite sure what I'm saying, because I don't regret the Craig run. That's not what I'm saying. But I just think by the final film, I was feeling sorry for him, and something sat very uncomfortable with me about feeling sorry for James Bond. That's not right. You can feel sorry for him in certain scenes, like when, say, Vesper dies or Tracy dies. That I get. Or when he realizes he's being betrayed by Elektra. You can feel sorry for him in moments, but you shouldn't be looking at him thinking, what a horrible life he's had. Which is where I got to with Craig.
Yeah, I kind of found Craig like a complete missed opportunity in the end, because just how great
he was that good.
Yeah.
If he's not to your taste, fine. I can respect that. He's not for everybody. Some people want the smoother and the suave, but that's fine. But I really liked him in the role. But they pissed slowly pissed it away.
Again, it's just the whole like. Yeah, I'm not sure if I said this in the review, in our initial review of No Time to Die, but the whole concept of killing Bond off at the end, spoilers.
The word spoilers before, Chris. Go on.
But like, you know, it's not been done, but the idea's been floated about so much, it's already tired.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not
the groundbreaking thing you think it is.
Yeah, exactly.
It's almost the, well, I suppose we've got to do it at some point. The whole Craig era was trying something new, and in Timescale, it was in its own little continuity bubble anyway. I don't want to reboot every time. I think that's the only answer, though, because it's very difficult to take it back to the Brosnan era now. But it was its own thing, and I appreciate the experiment. But it did go in a direction I couldn't quite follow it, even though the film that took it in that direction, which is Skyfall, I quite like. And I like it more over the years than I used to. I still think Casino Royale's clearly the strongest. I don't think it's not even debatable in my head, but I know some people disagree. Quantum is just a mess because of editing, but I like the film that's in there. It's only spoiled in execution because of writer's strikes and let's get what's hot right now, which was the Bourne editing team. So, but yeah, it went in a direction I didn't like. So by the end, I was a bit tired of it. And I just thought that was a shame. But what I should never do is look at Bond and think, your first love betrayed you. Then you were... basically, everyone you've cared about has either betrayed or died or left you. And so, you know, you've had a terrible life. And your best friend died earlier in the film. And the M you respected so much died, and you just start looking at his life and going, I wouldn't want that. Whereas even in the books, where he's dour and, dare I say, more Le Craig like, yes, Craig is more muscular and he's blonde, I get all that, they have made adaptations to the fact they're movies, but the essence of the character is very much in there in the Casino Royale film. But he did enjoy bits, like, if you remember Becker, he eats quite frugally at home, but then he goes away on a mission and it's like a pretty much open-ended expense account. So it's like, well, I may as well enjoy this. And that got so forgotten in the last decade or so. But then you got the other end of it where Roger Moore and Pierce Brosnan are running around seemingly feeling no peril because they're the best at everything they ever attempt and they're having a laugh while they're doing it. It's like the truth is somewhere in between, surely.
Yeah, I know. It's just inconsistency.
Yeah.
For it. It's just...
See, and people say Dalton got it right. Dalton did get it right.
Incredibly frustrating.
But Dalton couldn't do lines. Craig could deliver a line. So yeah, there's something to get. It is inconsistent, yeah.
He could deliver a line. What are you on about?
I did. Dalton couldn't do funny lines.
I mean, like Bond is essentially like we mentioned earlier about, you know, this obviously you kind of see little scenes. Like, there's a scene in Casino where he enjoys that kind of caviar on toast sort of thing, but we don't see a lot of like food snobbery, and especially like you know, food porn is a thing. Rise of cooking shows and everything from the 80s and 90s, definitely.
Yeah.
Oh look, here we are back at New Valley Railway. I'll tell you more about that in a minute.
Yeah, cool.
And I've been on that carriage. But yeah, no, it's just one of those things. It's like obviously, you know, food on Instagram is a thing. It has been probably since Instagram sort of came into being. But yeah, it's kind of a shame that we don't see Conor Bond enjoying himself very much anymore. And I think food snobbery is a big part of that. Yes, he's a snob. You know, saying what temperature you should drink sake at. The fact that he doesn't drink tea, you know, you should only eat certain types of food, and you know, red wine with fish and that sort of thing, or you know, not drinking red wine with fish. Yes, he's a food snob, but you know, he does know his stuff, and he gets. Whole passages. Obviously, you know, Fleming is putting a little bit of himself in Bond. Yeah, he was very much a foodie. He kind of ate and drank himself, you know, to all of his health problems as well. And Bond is very much the same. He does, you know, there are whole passages in many of the Bond novels where he goes into great detail about how, you know, how the scrambled egg recipe is quite intricate. Like, you know, the food that he's drinking, the wine or, you know, the wine that he's drinking, what the alcohol does, what part it plays, how it affects his insides. How it affects his liver and that sort of thing, but just like the feel of it as well. But yeah, we didn't see Bond being a food snob anymore, and I kind of lament that a little bit.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I think the Craig era was broadly accurate to what the books are, but it did overplay the sort of emotionless killer just a touch, because he didn't really like
just a bit too much.
But the bit it got right was the slightly emotionless, in that like he didn't let things affect him. He got on with it, and he was just but he was almost trained to be a gentleman. He was an orphan. He didn't come from massive amounts of money, and they trained him to be a gentleman. That snobbery was almost bred into him afterwards.
Sure.
So that bit of sort of the Craig version of the character is correct, and it's right almost by accident with Sean Connery as well, because Sean Connery the actor had to be taught to be that, and feel it in the character that he's a bit more blue collar than the actual character is showing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was very much from that working class background, wasn't he? And just,
well, he was a milkman, wasn't he?
He was, that's it. Then he probably got into the whole, you know, thing for his, like, because he was bodybuilding for a while as well, wasn't he? So that's kind of like his way in, definitely. But yeah, they're very much obviously Fleming pouring a large amount of.
So tell us about Nene Valley Railway now you're here. You said you're going to say a bit about this now you were here.
Oh yeah, no, just that. So it was very nice during that event that that red, I don't know what the word is, the small red carriage.
Carriage, yeah.
There is actual technical term for it. That's probably not carriage, not quite sure what it is, but they basically restored it. It's from the original film. They restored it and mock arranged for the original livery to be painted, so it's painted the same red.
All right.
The same details were kind of were sort of spray painted onto it, and at the event they presented the actual recreation of the actual Sign Octopussy Circus, which I believe now has been mounted to the carriage, and if you do visit Nene Valley Railway you can see it. I don't know if you can go inside. We had a sneak peek inside, and it was basically a small kitchen area and a fridge, just sort of food prep area basically, and a bit of storage, so it's not very exciting. But it was good fun. We had lots
but you're interacting with a bit of your own personal history, you know, because you've always loved this series.
Cool.
I do have all the time for that. It's great.
Yeah, and it was amazing, like some of the staff and volunteers have done there, just really incredible. And it was good, like the bit where we saw a few scenes ago where Roger's kind of obviously infiltrated the circus and carrying, you know, all the luggage and loading it onto was actually shot at Nene Valley Railway. And on the last day, on the Sunday, it was basically a meet and greet signing with all the cast and crew, those who are appearing at the event. It was very, very hot this weekend. Oh my gosh, so fair play to everybody on this. It was 1940s? No, I can't remember. Might have been kind of wartime, post-war, actually. So maybe sort of 50s time. Beautiful, beautifully decorated carriage. It was like something out of, as I say, Brief Encounter, but that was obviously kind of wartime. But kind of wartime, just post-war. No air conditioning. It was very, very hot. But I had a meet and greet in that carriage. In the scene where was it Olaf? Coming down the stairs, we went to this actual tunnel where they filmed it as well. And that was really cool to see inside. I felt didn't feel very safe walking along the train, walking on the train tracks, obviously, but next to it. And I was thinking, how safe is this? Obviously, there are no trains coming either way.
So extremely safe then, if you're not going to get hit by a train.
It kind of been blocked off.
But
a little
it doesn't
bit for
feel
us.
Safe.
No, we were like, obviously, don't trespass. So we got obviously we had to cross a section of the tracks, you know, that were going to be that was demarcated out. To actually get to one of the locations, but obviously it kind of been made safe to do it. But obviously they were very, a lot of the stewards and the staff were very on top of people for trespassing and kind of not going, you know, where they should have been. Safety is paramount, obviously, along the railway.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just really interesting to kind of see where they filmed these shots, how they marked it out. Obviously, the focus very much was on Octopussy, as rightly so, because it's the 40th anniversary of the film. Obviously, they made Goldeneye there too. I think obviously. There's more Goldeneye in Mark's book, so I can highly recommend that.
Okay.
But I kind of feel like, obviously, I think they had one of the small engines from Goldeneye, which is quite interesting to see. It's just a wonderful weekend, really. Listeners, if you were lucky to attend, please let us know. Spectatortalk@gmail.com. Drop us a line, tweet us, message us on Facebook. Yeah, I was there. Detail us. That was really cool. Any stories, memories that you have? I asked Mark for saying if there's any particular stories or memories. And he's like, oh no, it's all a bit frazzled.
Just
and
looking
we had
at,
a discussion.
Just on the film for a moment, looking at how serious Roger's face here is.
Yeah, he's very serious.
I just wish he'd taken the role a bit more seriously at times. Because he was never going to be the bruiser Sean was, so he could be dapper and debonair and good with his lines. But look at the face there. He could do this. Yeah. He could do this, but whenever he was interviewed, he said, well, the character's ridiculous. You know, he's known everywhere in the world. He walks in, they know his drink. He said, you've got to treat it as a bit of a joke, really. I don't know if he said the words a bit of a joke, but you get the gist of what I'm saying, Becca, and you've heard him say stuff.
I think that's why it makes this role the time. It's like, for example, Fiora's only was on ITV today, and obviously the scene where he kicks off the cliff. I think that's why it's I think that's why it makes it more shocking.
But he
effective.
Didn't want to play it that way. He didn't want to. Think like had he taken it just a degree more seriously, he could have been so good.
Kind of feel like he insisted.
Because you
line,
forget those quite. Moments. You forget those moments where he has that expression, and you're like, "Yeah, you could do this with those piercing eyes of yours as well."
You could be brutal. You could be brutal. Yeah. But I think that's why he kind of makes those moments are more shocking, especially of the. Obviously, you expect it from Sean. You expect it from Dalton. You expect it from Craig.
Yeah.
You don't expect it from Rog.
That's
so
true.
It does happen.
True.
It's all the more shocking.
True. It's a bit like when Brosnan shoots Kaufman and just pulls the gun back and says, "You know, me too." That's the one bit where I looked at him and thought...
When he shoots Elektra, it's quite shocking in Cold Blood.
Yeah, but his line afterwards was a bit weak.
It's a bit dodgy, but it's just that moment. It's quite shocking.
It's like, but it was like, you'll miss me. I get it's a play on that, but at the time I didn't. I didn't get it, right?
It's a bit cheesy.
I just wasn't concentrating. So he went, I never miss. And I'm like, well, you're 2 feet away. Of course you didn't fucking miss your bell end.
This is an amazing stunt as well. We met the driver. He did this stunt. He still
Where's Roger Moore? I can see him in the car.
He's still got the pen hub cap off that.
You met Roger Moore because he did it. Look, he's doing it there.
I know, he's there. And this is right outside the entrance in the valley as well. Which
isn't it amazing the railway as well. How East Germany looks in no way like Southern England.
Like, no, like Southern California. Follow that car. Oh my God, Bergwatt, such a shame. But yeah, we didn't miss him. That sounds really bad, but we didn't miss him. This is an amazing stunt as well, coming up.
Okay. I don't know how many times I've made it to this point of the film. Oh, look at that, yeah. Setting on the wrong track, brilliant.
I think it's Watermere, I'm not quite sure. I'd never been to Peterborough before until this point.
I went there a few years ago with work.
It's nice cathedral, yeah. Nice little city. But yeah, I've just never been, unfortunately.
It's not the sort of place. It's not the sort of place you go past. It's a bit like Norwich or something. You have to be going there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Must be your destination.
But I went there with work about 13 or 14 years ago. Because we had an office there. Oh, that's terrible back projection.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, they took quite a few steps to do it as well.
It's a question. What's your opinion on the kind of the novelty chase? So, like, for example, like, Goldeneye, like, you know, you've got the chase on the tank, with the tank. This is like, you know, like, kind of a car chase, but
I can't believe I'm going to say this because I famously hate this film, but I think this is done so much better than Goldeneye. The reason being that it's a very difficult line to draw, and I accept its suspension of disbelief, so I almost don't want to get into too much of a debate on it, because the opposite point of view's no less valid. But yeah. I think there comes a point where you put the general public in so much problems, that it's so much risk, the way of so much risk, that you take me out of the film. So in Die Another Day, where they're swinging blades around at each other at that club, and cutting through people's newspapers, and I'm thinking, you could be beheading the general public here. That tank is smashing through everything. And the other thing that takes me out of it is his head is not consistent. It's popping in and out of the tank every 2 seconds. I struggle with that sequence, though I get why people would like it. I must say, this is, apart from the bits of Brett projection here and there, which is more of a reflection of the era it was shot in, this is actually very well done. Novelty chases in general, I can't think of any other examples, really. I'm not fond of the tank chase in GoldenEye, not at all.
I think it's cool. I said on my original review.
I'm probably in a minority, though, because it's a well-regarded sequence in the film. That said, a lot of people don't like the backseat driver from Tomorrow Never Dies, and I quite like that sequence.
Yeah, I think that's really cool.
We're all different.
Yeah, I mean, there's always that. Even Dalton would have had it if that, you know, part of the third film of like him in Vegas with the monster truck. That would have.
What I read of possible third films was not good. But that said, they would have kept on writing all the way through production, so you don't know what it might have become. I mean, definitely he did two films and they were both very good. So to think he would suddenly, and the next film back, GoldenEye, may not be a favourite of mine, but it's well regarded, so why would we think a 1991 Bond film would suddenly drop the ball? I don't know. I, as much as I wish we had more Dalton films, I do think the break probably did us a favour, because it was all starting to look a little tired, and it when it came back, it had new creatives and a new MI6 team, and visuals had gone a bit further, and the Cold War had ended, and they'd had a bit of time to think about what they wanted to make. The only thing they did wrong is they made Brosnan a bit too greatest hits, but at least the film, at least it got a bit of a new lease of life. I don't know why he's keep trying to move. You're not going to catch the train. Oh, if I just pull a bit harder on this track, I'll get there.
That's quite funny as well. We also all tried to recreate the scene by going, "I would be a hero of the Soviet Union." It's quite funny. Yeah, for those of you who attended, yeah, we all had a go and tried to recreate the scene. It was a bit of a laugh. I think also, obviously, JDR were known for their sort of location visits. I believe Chris and a few other members of the team did a scene recreation. Not sure which one. I wasn't party of it. I was elsewhere exploring with other members of the group. But I think that's going to be coming soon, so keep an eye. Obviously, JBR has ended, but they still pop up from time to time. Keep an eye on their Facebook and on their YouTube. I'm sure they'll all be revealed soon.
Okay. Well, I think I still follow them. The only thing that makes me not sure is when they ended the podcast, I was like, well, there's nothing there to follow now, and I live a little too far away to go on many of the day things, so it's possible I unfollow, but I don't think so. I still see things.
Yeah, I still kind of follow them. They've got a trip coming up in the last weekend of July, and then there's another trip planned later on in the year. Yeah, I think the community's kind of still going, even though the podcast has ended. They might do like the odd show here and there. I think Chris made a trip to France not too long ago, and found some locations from like Thunderball and Moonraker. So yeah, it pops up every so often.
Well, and A View to a Killer, would have thought.
A View to a Killer, that was it, the Eiffel Tower.
Didn't they shoot some of John Wick 4 in the same places?
I think so, yeah. Arc de Triomphe as well. Yeah. Well, they also made Mission Impossible.
Yeah. I'm thinking more of the country estate there.
Oh yeah, I think they did, around Chantilly.
Yeah.
Yeah, around Chantilly, I want to say.
Okay.
And I was like, that was also seen in A View to a Kill.
Yeah.
Because we went there in 2017, we did the castles from Moonraker, Thunderball, and A View to a Kill.
Whatever you think of Moonraker, it's one of the very best. And allowing for the really dodgy fashions of the era, Moonraker.
It was the 1970s.
Moonraker is one of the very most beautiful Bond films. I don't know what it's the film stock or what, but not only
the. At least it's Paris. It looks beautiful.
They've shot it with this dreamlike quality. It's almost like Jeffrey Unsworth has shot it or something. because it's got that Superman the movie dreamlike quality to it.
Yeah, it does.
I really, really like the way Moonraker looks, apart from, you know, what they're wearing at points, but, you know, just the design of the film and the locations, because most of it was shot in France. It was because of British taxes at the time.
That was kind of a lot of those films. I think that's why so many films like On the Buses, Steptoe and Son, Carry Ons.
They all did Holiday On.
Because they were made over here.
Yeah.
Because it's too expensive. Because,
yeah,
you know, taxation was so high.
Yeah. I mean, it was a lot higher worldwide, but we were an outlier as one of the highest. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that is why they went to Paris. That's why they went to France, because of the tax breaks.
I'm not making no comment on whether that was right, wrong or not. It's not the point. The point is they shot a lot of Moonraker over there. Sometimes it's tax favourable tax breaks offered. I mean,
I think that's why
License to Kill was in a slightly lower tax era, and that wasn't shot here either. None of it was shot here.
No, it's interesting. I think some of Roger Moore's memoirs are quite interesting to read, because he's quite quite frank about these things. He says that it was taxation reasons, or he'll tell you, you know, that's why they did these things. But yeah, I think that's kind of why they did actually go to France.
Okay.
I got this train stunt. I think that was pretty cool. It was quite scary. It'd be terrifying. Yeah. A poor stuntman.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's fairly well shot, because the thing is, as well, train scenes have been overdone now. I saw one in Indy, and I'm like, oh, here we go, another train scene.
Yeah, it's a bit of a trope.
There's going to be like one tomorrow on the Mission Impossible film. A lot of it's going to be in the execution, but this running across the top of trains, we've been getting it. We had it in Skyfall, we had it in The Wolverine.
And it's quite a long sequence as well, to think of it. And yeah, it's quite kind of brutal.
I do find Roger's films are all about sort of 10, 15 minutes too long.
Oh, Roger, you can do it.
But I mean, they're really having to shoot around him quite carefully here, because, you know, you can't.
Because it's a stuntman.
It's a stuntman.
There
were shots in A View to a Kill where I couldn't believe it wasn't him. Like, he's on the floor on the Eiffel Tower with some like fishing shit wire around his legs, and it's a stuntman, and I'm thinking, you couldn't even do that bit?
No. Maybe the insurance didn't let him at it, Nick.
I mean, the stuff in Alaska at the start of the film.
Quite sharp wire, you know, Dave.
Eh?
Quite sharp wire, you know, Dave.
Ah, yeah, he could have.
Well, I've chafed
my ankle. But I mean, it's like the Alaska stuff. Is it Alaska at the start of the film? The stuff in snow, anyway. 5 days to Alaska. No, they're not in Alaska. They're in Siberia, aren't they? Roger Moore never set foot out of Pinewood for that stuff. No one expects him to be Tom Cruise, and no one even expects him to be Daniel Craig. But he didn't do anything. I'm surprised he did his own speaking scenes in case he dislocated his jaw.
That's a quote of the evening.
We're going to see something similar to this in Mission Impossible, aren't we?
Yeah.
Similar looking train. We are.
That is the guy, because I've told you I was rewatching not at a great speed, although I go through spells where I go through a lot of episodes, but I'm rewatching NYPD Blue. And I'm on about season 10 at the moment. And their boss, at that point, isn't the original guy. The black guy, James, whatever he was called, McDaniel, who was their first boss, left, and he was replaced by, I don't know how you pronounce his name, so I'm just going to go with how it's spelled, Eze Morales.
Because Nicholas Holt was going to be in it,
but he was the boss in NYPD Blue for about three seasons, and he is one of the bad guys he's the one you see Tom Cruise fighting on the top of the train.
Uh-huh.
So I'm watching him about 20 years before. Yeah, well, I've been going through that and a bit of different Star Trek series and seasons and things like that, so I'm just like watching a few different things. So hence nothing that quickly. Like, I started a rewatch of Cheers a long time ago and I'm still on it, but I'm only watching bits and pieces here and there. This is too long now. We're watching it without sound, and I get what they're trying to do, but this is now too long. Twat. And that makes
they are knobs, aren't they?
This is very much gonna be our Roger. Move!
Is that move. is that Pinewood Black Park? I don't know where that bit is filmed.
It
I'm not
looks
sure
a bit Black
in
Park.
New Belly. I wonder if it is Black Park. I think, yeah, we'll be going there with JBR in a couple of weeks.
I feel like Black Park doubled for everything. I think, you know, you see the ocean and you go, yeah, that's Black Park, that is. And then you see a Lamborghini and you go, yeah, that's Black Park, that is. That's actually a tree.
No, it's a Lambo.
Yeah.
Oh, look, it's Herbie.
Oh, I showed my wife the Love Bug and she didn't like it. I was gutted.
Oh.
Fucking Herbie. You know, how can you not like Herbie?
How can you not like Herbie? Oh my gosh. Yeah. I won't tell Rob Smith because he's got he's a massive fan of Herbie and he's actually got a Herbie. Sort of vintage Beatles, things like that, which is very, very cool.
Yeah.
But
the Love Bug's awesome. And Herbie goes to Monte Carlo when he falls in love with a Lancia.
It's fabulous.
The rest of them aren't that good, to be fair, but those two are brilliant.
Yeah, they're classic. Mm.
What about that remake with Michael Keaton and Lindsay Lohan?
Michael,
I didn't see that.
Michael Keaton, what?
Michael Keaton. There was a remake with Michael Keaton.
Do you mean... Is that the Lindsay Lohan one?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh,
The only thing they they made the headlights more like eyes. Herbie was slightly more expressive. But other than that, it was a pretty straight Herbie film, actually. It wasn't.
Okay, yeah, because she was like a mechanic working on the car, wasn't she?
But I remember the first one I ever saw was Herbie Goes Bananas. And that was really not very good. I watched it a few years later and it wasn't good at all.
Yeah.
Kabinda just stands around doing fuck all most of the time.
Yeah, he's a bit. He's a bit underused. Once they get to Germany,
he's just their mascot.
Underused.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, he is. I kind of feel, yeah, this is kind of like my problem, really. I mean, obviously, you've got Steve Berkoff, Phantasy Star 2, you've got Louis Jordan, famous, you know, actor in Europe, and obviously playing Dracula as well. I kind of feel like the villains in this film don't really have any teeth. But, you know, obviously, it's a Cold War, it's a little bit more nebulous. East v West, definitely. But I kind of feel like Louis Jordan doesn't kind of really peak villainous, you know, he doesn't kind of really get there, unfortunately. Although, it is brilliant having these two, like, titans of the screen kind of facing off against each other, but I kind of feel like it doesn't really get there. He's more of a kind of like cerebral villain, although he looks very stylish, you know, and he's very handsome, so it's almost a bit of a handsome off between Rog.
It's really weird when you suddenly leave the timeless elements, like when he was catching up with the train earlier, you suddenly saw some of the passengers and they looked like they should be in Biker Grove or something. And then we've cut away from it, and you're suddenly seeing like an 80s Fiesta or something. It really pulls you out of the timelessness of it somehow.
It was the 1980s. Oh, excuse me. Don't. Wrong film, but never mind. Oh!
And we're going to get Robin's orange
story.
This
whole bit is meant to be like relentless action, like this.
Bored now. I remember why I got bored with this film.
Just go on a little bit. They could just chop out the people, like, when he does...
I just think the whole thing is just way too long, and it's nowhere near the longest Bond film, but it feels like it, to me. Always feels like it. I've kind of forgotten the earlier bits of the film now, and it's going on too long. This is why I struggle with this film. Even if I loved Roger Moore, which I don't, and I certainly don't at 55 years of age, but even if I did, I think I'd struggle with this film. I just think it's... I don't know, it's a bit like, I think it's a far better film, but it's a little bit like when I watched Thunderball. It's like, because just on Thunderball, if it was in, you've got to think of it as it was released at the time. At the time, that photography was so innovative, it would have had a massive wow factor. But because it doesn't have that now, what we're left with is a film that is 25% people swimming very slowly. And fighting in this like really slow manner, and I think a lot of the people who made it aren't that fond of it, and I'm a little bit with that, like I am with this. I'm just thinking, I'll get to the end, don't you? I prefer Thunderball to this. Thunderball ranks, I think, just in the second half for me. It's like halfway ish but I appreciate it's bloody slow, and I have that problem with Octopussy, but the difference is Thunderball has Sean, it has better locations, it has incredible women, it's got that timeless 60s quality to it, it's got things about it I do enjoy. This doesn't have any of that, so I just get the fuck me on board. But this sequence is good, but we it's been cut by too much. Him getting from the train to here has been too long-winded. If he'd got from the train to here straight away, it would have carried on the same tension. But the tension has now all dissipated and they've got to build it up again.
Yeah, because it feels like sort of he spent too much time on the train and then had to find his way all the way back.
It reminds me of The Spy Who Loved Me, where he's got to make his way back to the office and in Cairo or wherever it was, and it just takes so long. It's like that. But I did at least think, the only reason I do think it's too long and I am a bit bored, but I do at least defend this sequence because there's a reason he's dressed as a clown. Mm. And he's actually got a very serious look on his face at the same time and stuff like that. And the kids don't know what's going on because it's a clown, so they're laughing. I think, I don't think there's much wrong with it as a sequence. I wouldn't have tried this with too many Bonds. I can't imagine Daniel Craig dressed as a clown in any way, shape or form. But it's far from the worst thing I've seen in this series.
I can imagine Dalton, not to say look dressed as a clown, but I can imagine Dalton doing a bloody move.
Oh. Yeah. You just get a bit like impatient with people. See Roger with Melina in that For Your Eyes Only is very, very like Tim with Cara. So I do think of them as sort of sister films. And they've both got slightly overlong third acts as well. And again, I can never remember what the plot's trying to achieve, and Orloff's dead now, so like his part's got nothing to do with it, and which bit does Kamal Khan want? I lose interest because it's too long and fragmented. And I struggle with Roger in this. And the thing is, I think by all objective measures, A View to a Kill is a worse film. But it was the first I saw in a cinema. And it's got that beautiful soundtrack. So I like it more.
Yeah, again, A View to a Kill is almost like a bit of a wasted... Again, a wasted opportunity.
It's a wasted entry because he shouldn't be there. So the moment they announce it, you're like, well, this ain't going to be that good, is it? You know, I'm thinking as if it was now, you know what I mean?
And it's one of Barry's best themes.
It's one of his best scores. It's his best score for years, actually. Probably Moonraker was the last one to that standard. Well, he'd only done one in the interim, actually, hadn't he? He'd only done this one. But this one's a bit nothing. By Barry's standards, they're still good. Yeah, I remember that, not being able to... But again, there was something very similar to that in The Spy Who Loved Me. They've got nothing new to do with Roger. He disarmed a bomb there where you couldn't touch the sides and stuff. A View to a Kill is almost parody, though, because he's an old man on a balcony talking to another old man about how he'll have to give his body to this young woman. And I'm like, no one's shagging you, mate. Honestly, if this was real life... you do get age gaps and you do get older action stars, but it's about the energy. He wasn't 57 as we understand it now. It wasn't 57 as Liam Neeson was when he was 57.
No.
Different era, different style, sensibility. I mean, if you're dressing him like he's about to go on Gardener's Question Time, it's not the same thing. And, you know, when you look at how much Craig damaged his body making Bond, you're thinking, well, maybe Roger was wise to say, I'll sit this out, they're paid to do it. I mean, Craig fucked his knee, his shoulders, he had teeth knocked out, he screwed his ankle, broke his leg, you know, an awful lot. He finished with a lot of injuries that he'll always have to live with.
Yeah, I don't know, he knocked his teeth out.
That was, I think it may have just been Caps, but it was a fist fight mistimed on Casino Royale. The press got hold of it and made it into something it
wasn't.
Yeah,
I kind of remember that.
We talked about it. But he definitely did a lot of damage to his knee. Brosnan damaged the knee on the last one. That was a sign he was getting too old, because he said, I didn't warm up enough. Well, younger actors wouldn't even have that problem. But, I mean, Roger obviously, presumably, never really got any injuries, because he never did anything more beyond some of the fist fights. And even they weren't particularly athletic.
Like, grab a railing and use your
feet. Yeah. He did do the double kick sometimes. That took a bit of effort. I love that. He's bewitching her with his tits. Well, it's she, sorry. Not a man. She's... Look at these tits. Men are always idiots in these films, aren't they? It's like in The Living Daylights when she comes in and sort of shows her cleavage and he's just immediately under her spell. And like, yeah, we can be a bit shallow men, but we don't completely lose it at just the merest slight of cleavage, honestly. Well, not often.
I think it's just a trope of a gag now, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was played as a joke, and it was the one bit of The Living Daylights that you're like, this was written when they didn't know who was playing Bond. And it works okay. It doesn't ruin anything.
Personally, I think it's just an opportunity to show some tits on screen anyway.
That's all it is, isn't it? It's look, cleavage. And it was a nice cleavage, I must admit. That's where I knew nothing about the bomb. So she's been used. So she's got a bit of agency. As I say, they've overplayed the sort of Bond damsel in distress. Some of the early Roger Sean films were a little bit problematic, and certainly as late as Roger trying to break her arm in her previous role as suddenly blanked on the name, Andrea Anders, in The Man with the Golden Gun, Roger tried to break her arm or threatened to break her arm, and that's not dated very well.
No, well, I mean, that's him trying to be more sure. Like yeah.
It just didn't suit him, and they didn't know what Bond he wanted to be, and I do think, you know, the Saltzman broccoli split and the 3-year gap and the sort of change of writing teams and everything else and getting Lewis Gilbert back, they just had an opportunity to go, what do we really want this to be? And they really sort of decided, let Roger be Roger. And it was a wise decision. He may not be my favourite, but if you're going to have him as James Bond, at least let him play what he's good at. I wish he'd taken it a touch more seriously, but only a touch.
Yeah.
I mean,
like, tone down
for Your Eyes Only didn't need the fucking parrot jokes and Margaret Thatcher. And I just think it doesn't actually do the film any favours. It doesn't quite ruin it for me. But, I mean, imagine that in The Living Daylights or something. It just, I mean, the parrot technically is, but you get my point. And it just doesn't really work for me. And I just think, like, if you weren't desperately going, how can we make this funnier all the fucking time and looking for a gag all the time and just let the one-liners come to you, like in The Spy Who Loved Me, where they genuinely did present themselves, you'd have been a little better. I mean, James, I need you. So does England. I mean, that's fucking brilliant. Tell him to pull out immediately. It's brilliant. And it's silly and it's daft, but it suits the scene. And the scene gave you the opportunity for that laugh. But they're always trying to force it. Let's do a Tarzan yell. It's not funny. Somebody presumably laughed, but I don't know. When people say they want to go back to a suaver or lighter Bond, I don't think they're thinking of many specific jokes. I think they're thinking just more of the tone. Because the jokes weren't funny. by and large.
It's just a bit of... Yeah, I think it's going to be a bit...
Suavo tends to be the movie fans. They grew up with a Brosnan lighter. Or something. They think his hair should never move, and he's like instantly exceptionally sexy in all scenarios. Because the book Bond isn't particularly suave. He's a bit of a woman. He is a bit of a womanizer, so he has an appeal to women. But he's not sort of sexy in that way. Sean doesn't look like the description of him, but he embodies it about right, actually. Q's off for about an eightsome. Yeah, like The World Is Not Enough was only actually shot 1 year later. He just had a very, very busy year of shagging, and it aged him quite a bit. I mean, even the joke from Moonraker, you know, the... is it from Moonraker? I don't know. I'll get to it in a minute. His hair's not moving. God, it looked bad when Harrison was on the horse, didn't it? When you got a close in and it was so obviously green screen and like the fake bit of the front of a horse.
Yeah. What, in the New York?
Yeah, it didn't look good.
But again, most of that bit of like, look, it was filmed on set, though, wasn't like a lot of it.
Yeah. The stunt doubling here is not very good. I mean, partly he keeps having to hide his face because it's not him, but also when you do get a look at him, he looks nothing like Roger Moore. I don't expect him to hang from a plane, but I don't know. Part of it is he's just too old. You can't find people who look that much like him.
Yeah.
We haven't heard Becca for a while because she had to take a call and just said for us to continue. She will be back in a moment, hopefully.
Yes, she needs to sign off, really, didn't she?
She does. She's muted at the moment, but she'll be back with us before we finish.
Yeah.
There's some good stunt work. I mean, I do think John Glenn was very, very good at set pieces.
Yeah, and you know, you forget all this stuff. Because like even think like it's like Moonraker, like it's got to be one of the first time like they've actually done that, like of a free fall kind of like in the air kind of action sequence.
I mean, John Glenn did shoot
and you just forget because oh it's, you know, Roger Moore and
we think of him as the action light Bond, but they still gave him plenty of set pieces. It's just he wasn't on screen for large sections of it because it's all stunts. But then. Again, we're only talking about balance. We're talking about a guy who's too old who has to be doubled for so much that it keeps taking you out of the scene because it doesn't look like him. And the guy doesn't give off the air of somebody who could do any of that anyway. So it's very difficult. I mean, that is so clearly not Roger Moore there, where we've just got to look at him. And then there we are against sort of blue screen. So, but we're not saying it has to be like Sean Connery. I mean... It's not Sean Connery, I meant Tom Cruise, sorry, in that we don't expect... There became a thing a few years ago where actors suddenly started talking about doing as much of their own stuff as possible. And actually, because of insurance, it was largely bullshit anyway. It was one of those things that people said, but wasn't quite true. And then you got to somebody like Craig, who was able to do a reasonable amount of it the first time out.
Mm.
But, I mean, A, they didn't do everything, and B, they did get injured quite a bit. We're just talking about balance. We're not suggesting Roger Moore should have taken his life in his hands. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, yeah, by the next film, he's being doubled in sequences where you go, well, the character's not doing anything. Why is it a double? You're telling me he cannot be filmed stood up on the Eiffel Tower? He was a couple of shots ago.
I think, yeah, it's probably just how it was filmed at the time.
So, let's make love. Not me and you, Chris. I meant those two. yeah.
personally, I thought the most unbelievable thing in that whole sequence was the French guy's accent and like and moustache.
Yeah. He managed to be real comedy French. Oh no, he's so injured. Look, he's badly hurt.
That's what you think.
Yeah, well, the evidence is in front of my eyes. He wouldn't cheat her, would he? I don't know why he's bothered with all that. I mean, when you think he's already had sex with her.
Yeah, but look at his face. But I love Roger's expression.
But he's already had sex with her. Why did he have to do all that bullshit? Was it a quiet game of you're not getting any cock tonight? Oh, well.
It was fun.
But, yeah, all very sort of safe and nice. I don't know how much of a disappointment it would have felt after For Your Eyes Only, and I can't judge because I would have seen them around this time. When would I have seen them? I would have seen them early 85 probably, and I got them all from the video shop, but when you're a kid, For Your Eyes Only is quite boring, so I didn't really like it that much then.
No, it wasn't kind of... It's a more character-driven piece, isn't
it? Oh, I love it now, but a nine-year-old me didn't like it.
No.
So I probably didn't feel the same way, but certainly as an adult, I would have been really disappointed by this. There's Octopus... Mary Staven was in this as well.
Mary Staven, yep. She couldn't make it.
And the gymnast was supervised by Suzanne Dando. She used to be on TV a lot in this country.
The Suzanne Dando.
I didn't know that.
Wow.
But yeah, Mary Staven. Mary Staven, for anyone listening, was one of the Miss Worlds that George Best, the footballer, English footballer, dated. And he dated her around 83, 84, when he was like really late in his career somewhere. And she was the one that Roger Moore said, it's 5 days to Alaska.
Yes.
To
yeah, she
the one who's not go. Farrah Fawcett, her.
She does have that Farrah Fawcett hairdo, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. Because it's an apocryphal story. It didn't actually happen, but he always claimed it was with her. He was in a hotel with her. They went out to a casino. He won a massive amount of money, came back, put it on the bed, and basically shagged Miss World on it. Then they ordered room service, and when the room service guys arrived, he said, Mr. Best, I've always wanted to ask you, where did it all go wrong? And he's just had sex on thousands of pounds, but they just meant his alcoholism and his career going through. But he made that up for a story. I don't think it actually happened.
That feels like it should be some kind of bad joke, yeah, but it's not.
It's not. But yeah, they filmed London, India, Germany and the USA and other parts of England. I mean, they really did make an effort with this. Look at all the bodies they've worked with. Utah State Film Commission, that was from where that was shot, that last bit. Ean Valley, From A View to a Kill.
From A View to a Kill, yeah, using the book's film title.
Yeah, they changed their mind before it came out. And there it is, Octopussy, my least favourite Bond film, and I managed to get through it without really slagging it too badly, I think.
Is your opinion of it improved now, Dave?
I don't think it'll ever change in that I remembered, because I have a strange amnesia watching the film, in that I know I don't like it, but I always put it on with a bit of hope. And at points during that watch, there was a bit of hope. I was thinking, oh, there's a bit of tension in that sequence, or I quite like this bit, or I'm going with it. And I remembered when they were on the train, which I forgot was about to happen, I was like, oh, we got the bomb bit coming up in a minute. But the lull between the two bits killed it. So I remember the film fundamentally is not paced in a way I like, and it's too long.
No, it does suffer a little bit. It is like a film with two halves, pretty much. It's kind of like, doesn't know if it wants to be like a fun film, a Bond film that's out there, or if it wants to be like a cold, you know, a hard-nosed Cold War film.
I mean, by the end of that film, you've totally forgotten Vijay Armitage, and he was in most of it.
Yeah, it's a shame. It's he's kind disjointed. Of underused. The villains are kind of underused a little bit. Literally, you feel they have great teeth. I mean, Sir Roger looks great, but it's one of those films. It is very much a film of two halves there, and they don't really kind of intersect. But still, I had a great time with it, So I'm just going to give one last plug to the Ean Valley Railway event that happened in June.
What, you want people to go back in time?
I do.
You don't, you're not plugging the event, are you? You're plugging...
No. I'm really plugging Mark's book, definitely. So, if listeners, sorry to bang on, but I thought as we're doing this Octopussy commentary, I really have to mention it. But yeah, listeners, if you're familiar with On the Tracks of 007, even if you are, that's great. If not, do check them out. I believe it's onthetracksof007.com, or just Google On the Tracks of 007 and you'll find it. Amazing website. As I say, they organise all kinds of Bond-related tours and trips. There'll be one happening again soon. They did one recently to Sydney Valley and also to Jamaica, celebrating Doctor No and Casino Royale and Indeed Thunderball. And they often attract, you know, the surviving stars from the world of Bond. So it's really high caliber events. But yeah, shout out to Mark Hernandez, who wrote and compiled this book On the Train Tracks, from Octopussy and Goldeneye and Indeed Valley Railway. The book's available from all good retailers and also from On the Tracks of 007. Check it out. It's about £20, it's, you know, relatively cheap to buy, but it's full of amazing information and photos from also, you know, staff, cast and crew and volunteers at Indeed Valley Railway. Really can't recommend it highly enough. And it's quite nice because the Octopussy 40th anniversary event raised about £5,000, nearly £5,000 for the Indeed Valley Railway, which is a heritage railway you can visit in Peterborough. Highly recommend that, even if you're not into steam. Like, sadly, I'm not what you call a train spotter. Not particularly interested in the steam railway, but, you know, I went there and learned a lot quite about the heritage railway, so it was really eye-opening and really interesting to read as well. So yeah, just like, you know, just sort of plug that, really. It's quite interesting to see kind of where they filmed the various scenes, how they set up shots, and to, you know, kind of really get behind the scenes with the cast and the crew, and the volunteers of the railway as well. So it kind of, I can appreciate the film more having done that, for sure. I mean, yeah, it into kind of won't change a little bit, but I can appreciate how they made it and the setups and the choices that they made and decisions that they made. And it was just a wonderful weekend, and it was great to meet sort of Andy Bradford, Tony David Meyer, John Glenn, they were both of his sons, Christine Wayborn. Oh my gosh, I can't believe we had dinner with her. That was amazing. And it's just a wonderful weekend. But definitely, I just want to plug Mark Hernandez's book.
If you're listening, Christina, we're all available for dinners.
Yes, this is it. Yeah, can I say that I shared a dessert with a Bond girl, so it's like, that's amazing. But yeah, definitely, I just want to just plug the event, really, and plug Mark's book. And this is the perfect time to do that. So yeah, do check out On the Train Tracks, Film of Octopussy and Goldeneye at Indeed Valley Railway. And thank you very much to Mark, Martin and Anders, and to everybody who organised that weekend. It was wonderful. We left there on all-time high.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Ba-dum-tsh.
Hey.
I thought I'd spoon it in at the last minute. I'd try and cram it in.
Yeah, only really works for that film, doesn't it?
Well, it does. But it was fantastic. It was, you know, I can. They organised the Majesty's event back in 2019. If anybody listening went on that,
I didn't go on it. I watched it. I wish I'd gone.
Yeah, it's one of those. It's really kind of once.
I couldn't afford it at the time.
Once in a lifetime. I probably won't ever go there again, just for sheer cost.
The thing is, it is a bit, if there's a will, there's a way. Because my thinking was, I couldn't afford it. Becca really couldn't afford it, and she went. So it's doable generally. But there you go.
Yeah, I said, like, there's right. I called in some favours and said,
there's
right.
Always the 60th. Yeah, but then who's still going to be around then? We'll see.
I know.
Okay, as for social media, you can find me at ThePastyKid1976 on Twitter.
You can find me at SimTracks on Twitter. You can also find all the episodes on Podbean and any of your listening
All the
devices.
Episodes, asterisk, to be confirmed.
Yes.
Yeah, Podbean, Podbay, Spotify,
YouTube,
generally where you can pick up your podcast.
YouTube.
And don't forget, listeners, wherever you do, YouTube, we're all on YouTube. And obviously, listeners, don't forget, wherever you're listening to us, please give us a review and a rating, possibly 5 stars if you can. Helps us to rank higher and attract more listeners. And if you find yourself listening to us randomly, whatever platform you're on, want to do a status update. Hey, I'm listening to, let your friends know what you're listening to. I'm listening to Do You Expect Us to Talk? Just pop that link in your socials and share us if you can. That'd be lovely. Thank you very much.
And is that our final Roger?
Well, I hope I've got a few more in me before I die. yes, it is. It is. Caveat, we lost 40 minutes of your audio in the Moonraker commentary.
Yeah.
So I want to redo Moonraker one day. There's only two.
Oh, have we not redone Moonraker yet?
We haven't redone it yet. Haven't we?
Okay,
we redid A View to a Kill. Listeners, if we redid Moonraker and we've forgotten about it, please let us know. But I'm pretty sure we didn't. We redid A View to a Kill because we didn't talk about the film. We had Mark O'Connell on, and somebody said afterwards, I would have loved to have heard something about the film. And I'm like, yeah, fair point.
Well, here we are known for going
Moonraker. I mean, there's a whole thought process about Foghorn Leghorn that's been lost.
I'll say, boy.
Honestly, we discussed.
I don't think that can come back though.
Well, it can. It can. It'll be. But it'll be very like the plot of Paddington 2. It'll have to be largely behind bars. Because Chris went on at length as to how we should have cast. They should do a live action Foghorn Leghorn film with Kevin Spacey doing the voice. But this was before any of.
Yeah, no, we can't say that.
Well, we can, but it's just. Not as good, but yeah, there was some really good
stuff. But
what's left of the show is me responding to stuff, but you can't even hear what I'm responding to, and it was really good. So I would still listen to it because it's a 2-hour film and there's like 40 minutes that don't quite make sense. But you know, if you...
and then also I can recount you with tales of how in 2017 JBR went to Drax's chateau. So yeah.
So there's a chance we'll redo Moonraker, but our next priority with Bond.
Yeah, we'll redo it.
We've got Thunderball to do. We've got No Time to Die to do as well. So they'll come at some point. Although next up in the Bond series, we said we'd cover the books, and so we're going to do Casino Royale, and that's only going to be in about 3 or 4 episodes' time. We've got the next episode we'll sign off for in a minute, and then we've got to decide on what our next series is, but guys.
Yeah, we'll have a bit of a discussion.
We're going to do a short series, and we'll do that, and then we'll do Casino Royale as a one-off
review. Yeah.
We don't know if that'll be a half-hour episode, an hour episode, or an hour and a half episode. Who knows? Find how much.
We're still working it out, but as soon as we've got our next series lined up, because we've had to do a bit of reshuffling. But yeah, as soon as we've got our next series lined up, there's a bit of organisation I have to do behind the scenes. But then as soon as we know, we'll be able to let you lovely listeners know.
So yeah, next weekend we will record a new episode for an existing series, which means, Becca.
Which means your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to review Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning Part 1.